5, 4, 3, 2, 1, boom, and we're live. What's up, brother? How are you?
Very, very good.
Thanks for doing this, man. I'm very excited to have you in here.
I'm honored to be here, man. I was just thinking about this the other day, actually. I was like, the fucking people that have been on the show, man.
Yeah, I think about it sometimes, too. Freaks me out.
Sam Harris, James Hetfield. I was thinking about all the people, man. I was like, how do I compete with these guys?
Just be Matt Brown.
I know.
What are you talking about, man?
I know. I mean, I could beat all their asses, but...
Well, in certain situations, that's all that counts.
The situations that I thrive in.
Exactly. So, you were retired, and now you're not. Now you just signed to fight Carlos Condit?
You got it.
Damn, that's a good fight. I like that.
Yeah.
I think Carlos needed to fight back, too. That fight with Neil Magny, he looked like he was suffering through some ring rust.
I've talked to a lot of people about that because that's the first thing that always comes up, right, is how he came back and looked in that fight. And I've trained with Neil a lot, man. I tell you, Neil can shut a fucking game down right away.
Yeah.
You know,
he's very good.
Yeah,
very
we can't underrated. Take away from Neil, man. Carlos didn't seem to show any sense of urgency either, though. So, you know, I think it's both sides, but... I think he's also going to be looking for redemption with me.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah, he wanted to come back right away, actually. They actually asked me to fight. It would have been like 6 weeks' notice.
What's the longest you've ever taken off?
After I fought Cowboy, got knocked the fuck out, and took a year off and fought Diego.
So what is it like coming back after a year?
It felt natural to me, personally.
To you?
Yeah.
So it's different for different people, right?
Yeah, someone was talking to me about this the other day, ring rust, and I was like, you know, everybody's different, man. Every single person is going to react a little differently, and I think also when you have someone, you know, John Danaher was talking about like the different types of fighters, right? I think he just grouped three different types of fighters, like a violence guy, a tactical guy, and something else. Well, I think there's more types of fighters than what he went through, but there's, I think it's going to affect every single type of person differently. You know, and I fought, for instance, I fought a much more tactical fight against Diego. It wasn't, I mean, you could easily go in with Diego and just go to fucking war with him, right? I mean,
Gilbert Melendez style.
Exactly. Yeah. He's totally down for that. Like, what Diego is, you know, he will wake right up and go for that, right?
Yeah.
I was like, man, I'm better than him. Let's just be tactical. And I think that was part of why it helped. Now I think someone that goes in with a more violent style, which I've done many times in my life, I think that's a bit more complicated because there's a lot more timing and reaction in that. Whereas the strategy, you have a very clear path to victory. You know exactly what you got to do. It's just you're just going in there and just you know, connecting the dots when you get in there
and staying on the plan.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, when you get a guy like Diego, though, that temptation has got to be always there, right? Because he's so willing.
Well, if it's necessary.
Because you love that kind of fighting.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the reasons why you're so loved.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's never been a Matt Brown fight ever that's boring. There's a lot of guys that have, because of styles, because of whatever, they've had fights that weren't very crowd-pleasing.
Mm-hmm.
But your style has always been do or die, seek and destroy. That's one of the reasons why people love you.
Yeah, well, I mean, that just goes back to my mentality of why I'm fighting to start with, right? It's not really about just winning. I think that's sort of a Western culture thing, sort of an American thing. Like, I kind of go back to the original pride, and it's like, look, just fight, man. You know, this is a fun thing. This is a badass thing we're doing. This is an amazing thing. Go in there and fight. Test yourself, the Bushido spirit, things like that. And not, it doesn't have to be just win at all costs. You know, this is, you know, to me, it waters down the sport. I mean, that's not what combat is about. So, this, you know, it's not me.
Well, I mean, that's what makes it interesting is that there are different styles. There's people that have safety first styles where they're just fighting to win. And then there's other people like yourself that just whatever's inside you that comes out. You know, I always said this, like there's certain dudes like because of your history, because of... I mean, you had an overdose where you literally died. And there's the same with Court McGee. He had the same situation happen to him. I always said
I talked to him about it.
Dudes that have gone to the other side are fucking terrifying inside the cage. There's like there's a certain thing. I don't know if it's just coincidentally that both of you guys have that mindset, or let's forget about even Cora, but you have this mindset. And I've always said, I wonder if there's a correlation between such extreme lows in your life where you bottomed out so hard, literally your body had shut down and you were ready to pass on. The doctor saved you, and you've got a mindset going into that cage that's just, it's just another notch more intense than most people.
Certainly, and that's, you know, to be honest, that's something I've sort of struggled with a lot too, because it wasn't actually that specific moment, the overdose, that kind of affected me the way it did. It was more a long-term life of, well, I would say I've just been an angry person, honestly, like just since I grew up. So it was all about channeling that anger.
A lot of fighters like that, right?
I think so. I think it's one of the beauties of martial arts, right?
That helps you channel that?
Yeah. I mean, we all have to find an outlet. I didn't discover martial arts until, 22, something like that. And, you know, so before, my outlet was drugs and alcohol. You know, that was my way to say fuck everybody, right? And, you know, it just went too far. But the, like I said, you know, when it is expressed in the cage, that's more of a long-term thing. Growing up an angry person, and then, you know, I always give a lot of credit to Jamie Josta, Hatebreed. You know, that's who I walk out to nowadays. It's a dream come true to have a walkout song by them. And that was like the first time that I was able to find a positive outlet for that energy. You know, I didn't know what heavy metal was growing up. You know what I mean? I grew up in a small farm town, and I didn't know what that was. But heavy metal gave me an outlet, and Hatebreed was the first one that gave me a positive outlet. Before, it was negative. Pantera, Slayer, like stuff like this. It's all negativity, you know. So this rage is coming out in a negative sense and gets expressed through drugs, alcohol, hanging with the wrong people, things like that. And then there's a turning point where I'm like, man, this can be a positive thing, and I can use this energy directed towards something positive.
What were you angry about growing up?
Good question. Man, that goes deep, man, because, you know, I grew up in a very, very, very small town, 200 people population. I didn't see a skyscraper until I was, I mean, like up in person, like we drove by it in Dayton, Ohio, which isn't a big town in itself, until I was like over 18 years old, you know. So I always felt like there was so much more out there for me. And I was kind of I grew up in a machine shop. My dad was a machinist, so I was doing that from like 5 years old. I was sweeping the fucking floor. And I was like, man, this is not what I'm meant to be. Like, I'm supposed to be something great. But everybody around me is like, no, this is what you do. You live in this little town and you follow the rules. You're going to be a machinist or a farmer or, you know, whatever. And, you know, that shit pissed me off, you know, and I never really found my niche. And so I was homeschooled actually for, I think, 2 years in junior high. So I think that was sort of actually the start, because I went back to school. And when I went back to school, I was now the outsider. I didn't have any friends. And then going up, all of a sudden I'm in high school and I have no friends. I have no, I can't get laid for shit. I think that's what causes anger in a lot of people in the world, right?
Oh, yeah, and depression.
Yeah.
That's a big factor.
Yeah, and at the exact same time, I'm starting to experiment with drugs and alcohol. So you put the two together, you know. I was supposed to be the prodigal son, you know what I mean? Like, I was very intelligent. I was, you know, I was doing things by the time I was 15 years old in the machine shop that guys, you know, they've been working for my father for 10, 15 years, couldn't do. You know what I mean? So I was sort of this prodigal son. I was good at athletics and everything. Had no problem with all that stuff. So I think it was just sort of a backlash, you know, and then I let that anger get the best of me.
So now, when you were doing drugs and alcohol, what were the drugs? Like, what was the drug that caused you to overdose?
Heroin. An injection, yeah.
Damn, that's deep. When you're injecting it, that's when you're all in, baby.
Yeah, and, you know, I didn't actually do it a whole lot. It's kind of the funny thing. A lot of people thought that I was addicted to heroin, and I wasn't. I think that was probably the fifth time that I did it. Maybe six, something like that. I didn't count, but, you know, that was sort of my... Fuck, that was my step into the dark side, you know, and a blessing and a curse, man. You know, it immediately, I was like, oh, okay, that's what can happen, right?
Right.
The step back. And, you know, I was very naive, very, man, I was a fool, really. Like, because what I did, I remember leaving the hospital. I was like, okay, well, I'm never doing heroin again, but let's go do some coke. <You know>? Right? So I was just a dummy, man.
Wow. And, how old were you?
I think I was 21, 22, one of those. I mean, that was like 15 years ago. There's a lot of stuff. I was actually kind of thinking about, like, so again, you know, on this podcast, I was like, you know, it's probably going to come up on it. It's a pretty intense story. I was like, damn, I can't remember all the details of that shit. It was like a long time ago. But anyway, yeah, so I was like 21, 22, and it wasn't too much long later. You know, I lived with this girl, and, you know, she was a drug addict too, and she had a couple kids. And it was like, all right, well, now I got a place to live. Like, let's get fucked up. You know, and it was, I never did... heroin again after that, obviously. I think I did oxys, though. Percocets, stuff like that.
Which, oxys, basically the same thing, right?
Yeah, just which I mean, I didn't realize it at the time. But really, my drug of choice was meth back in that day. That was what I really liked. That was actually what I was addicted to at one point. And I ended up going to jail, and that was what got me out of addiction. I didn't realize I was addicted until I was in jail. So
what made you realize it when you were in jail?
I just you know, just couldn't stop thinking about it and just wanted it, and just, I mean, I didn't have like cold sweats or anything. I don't think that happens with uppers, but I mean, I was just, you know, like couldn't stop thinking about it, man. I was like, dude, like, just a lot of that anger was coming out. I was just like, God, like, what the fuck? Like, I wanted to fight everybody. I was like, somebody give me something, you know? And
wow.
Yeah, it was just a really terrible experience, but probably only lasted 3-4 days. Not even, maybe not even that.
And then you came out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I was just like able to accept my fate and deal with it.
What does it feel like to be on meth?
You ever take Adderall?
No.
I never taken an Adderall?
No. Pretty similar to Adderall, right?
Yeah, it's like Adderall. I mean, that's the closest I would say. I mean, you're high, but you don't have... I mean, it's a euphoria more than anything. Just a...
Excuse me.
Just an extreme sense of euphoria. Just everything's beautiful. But then, man, as soon as you start to lose that a little bit, you just itch for it so bad, man. So bad. Like, you just want it again. You don't want to sleep. You, like, your teeth would be grinding. You're just like, you're just tensing up all your muscles. Like, God, well, I got to get more of that, you know?
Now, were you working out at all back then?
No.
Nothing?
No. Well, not working out like I should be. So, again, I was angry. A lot of times, like, I'd be at a party. This was a common thing. I'd be at, like, a party or just doing drugs, whatever. And I just start getting, look at everybody, like, I fucking don't like none of you. And I would just walk outside and I would go for a run. I'd run 5-6 miles, come back, and be like, all right, give me another line or whatever.
Wow.
Yeah.
You would run and then come back to the party?
Yeah. And then sometimes I would fight people. You know, that was common, very, very common, if you call that working out. and we'd, like, this particular time in my life, I was living in a little town called Jamestown, Ohio, and I had this buddy. He was friend, his cousin, well, his cousin was a fighter, and this was kind of my first, foray into mixed martial arts, our first, experience watching it and everything. And, they would train in the grass in the backyard. You know, I remember watching Ken Shamrock DVDs or VHSs back then. Leg locks. We'd go on the living room floor, like just be shit faced drunk, and I'm lucky I didn't tear my ACL or anything. We're like, oh, this is what he's doing. This is how you do it.
Heel
just,
hooks.
Yeah, heel hooks. And I mean, I don't remember all the techniques, but I remember it was like, you know, pancration stuff, right? And we'd just be laying there, and it was always a thought of like, dude, this is fucking awesome, man. Like, I could beat Tank Abbott. Like, what are you doing? You know, and we would joke about it, man. We would say, I remember specifically sitting there and be like, dude, like, you know, we're going to get you a fight in, you know, the local Joe Schmo show, and then, you know, we're going to get you up, and you're going to go to a Pride, and then you're going to go to the UFC. And I was like, oh, cool. Hell yeah, let's do it. And that was, you know, it was like a joke, kind of, but that, like, that was what was in my head. That's what we were going
to
do.
Introduction to martial arts.
Yeah.
So what was your first real formal training? Like, what gym did you first?
So I fought before I trained.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, so so actually this guy that was he was supposed to go fight Wes Sims, and his name was Fat Joe is what we called him. He was supposed to go fight Wes Sims that day, and I said, yeah, let's go, man. I want to go with you. I want to see this shit up close, right? And so we go there, and I'm doing a bunch of coke on the way, and you know, to me it's just gonna be a party. Like, I'm just gonna watch my dude fight. I get there, and you know, he signs up on the table, and I was like, dude, what is that? How you know that's all you got to do? He's like, yeah. He's like, you just pay $30 and you come fight. I said, man, maybe I should do that. And then the guy, and I'm looking inside, and I see the you know, people sitting around smoking cigars, like you see on a movie, people smoking cigars. You see bets being made and stuff, and the guy goes, man, you want to fight the champion? Like, nobody wants to fight him. And I was like, fuck yeah, man, I'll fight him. Are you kidding me? So I literally went across the street. There's a sporting goods store across the street or down the street or something. Went and bought a mouthpiece. Come back. There's a restaurant across the street. Boiled the mouthpiece at the restaurant. Used their microwave. Come back. And then we're at the fighters meeting. So the fighters meeting back then was a lot different. So there wasn't weigh in. It was like you guys look about the same size. You guys doing kickboxing? Okay, you guys fight. Right? So that's how the way it worked out. And I'm sitting there, and they're like, okay, you're the champion. You're fighting him. And I was like, oh, shit, all right, fuck this motherfucker, right? And, you know, so I'm sitting by the station. This guy, he taught me how to do a jab. He's like, man, he's like, all you got to do to beat this guy, just jab him. He's like, you see this? Just throw this jab. I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to do that. And went out there, and I beat the guy. So he actually quit. Yeah, he actually quit, you know. So he was a tough man champion is what he was. And I actually threw a jab, punched him in the face, and he went to shoot on me. I did, you know, a playground guillotine choke, and he just quit. I don't think I actually had the choke in. I highly doubt. You
did
know,
he tap?
He tapped out, saying that his calf cramped up. I have no idea, you know, like what really happened. I mean, I certainly didn't know a guillotine choke. I didn't even know the name of it. So anyway, later that night, I was like, dude, like, your fight didn't go very long. You want to fight again? Yeah, whatever, man. And they said, well, this guy, you know, he's going pro in his next boxing match. You're a kickboxer. Let's fight him. I said, all right, I'll fuck him up, right? I'll go do it. This dude beat the shit out of him. So that was actually the nice thing about that was it actually made me realize how tough I am. That was the saving grace. I mean, he just, you know, just pieced me up, just one punch after another. You know, I'm just eating punch after punch. And then, yeah, that was it. I said, man, I got to do this shit. And then, so my second fight, I didn't think I still yet needed to train. My second fight, I met a guy at a gym. So, you know, I did go to this gym. It was a Japanese jiu-jitsu gym. And he goes, hey, man, you want to fight in like 2 weeks in Muay Thai? Hell yeah, right? So for 2 weeks, you know, I hit the bag probably for 5 minutes at a time, whatever, or something. I go to the fight, and, man, this is the worst part. So I get in there. The first thing the guy does, comes in, shoots on me, takes me down. We're in big gloves, shin pads and all this. Takes me down. I'll get up, look at the ref. What the fuck? He's taking me down. We can't do this. Muay Thai. Right? He's like, fight, you know. Comes in, takes me down again. I was like, what the fuck, man? So I was like, okay, so we're fucking wrestling, right? So I come out and get in sort of a wrestling stance, drop my hands, fucking kicks me in my head. So we'll come find out later. San Shao, not Muay Thai. Scott Shealy's show. I used to work with him a lot.
San Shao, for people who don't know, was kickboxing with takedowns.
Yep,
I cornered Maurice Smith back in the day when Maurice was doing that once.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, in Burbank, I think it was. It was weird. It was confusing. It's like, okay. I mean, it's interesting, I guess. Mm. I mean, it's probably a good skill set to learn how to do takedowns and throws with kickboxing, but then you just let the guy up, which is just weird.
You didn't get it, huh?
It was weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it still goes on today. Sanda, essentially. Yeah. I think it's an amazing sport. I love it.
It's amazing. Yeah. And it's
Kung Lee.
A lot of times it's a lot like throws in Muay Thai, because, you know, there's a lot of trips and throws in Muay Thai.
Except you get points for the throws.
Yeah.
Up to five. Yeah.
Another variation. Yeah.
Yeah. I think if like their feet go above their head, it's 5 points.
So when did you get serious? So you did this.
So it was right after that. Because, I mean, he beat the shit out of me. I remember walking out of there and people were looking at me like, damn, how'd you survive that, bro? I mean, and like people were actually asking me that, like, dude, how did you survive that shit? I'm like, I don't know. I had to go to work that night. I was like working third shift. I had to go to work right after. Everybody was looking at me at work like, dude, you got like two black eyes? That was when I said to myself, you know, I want to try this. And, you know, I think, you know, this is something I really enjoy and I want to go for it. So I met this guy. His name was Eli Ayers, and he was fighting in King of the Cage, one of the toughest guys I've ever met, and then a guy, Braden Workman. And they were training for, it was a big show there in Columbus. I can't remember the name of the show, but I think like Lawler fought on it, like a bunch of Miletich guys, Tim Sylvia. You know the name if I say it, I can't remember. But anyway, and then, you know, then I really got the shit kicked out of me when I got in the gym. You know, then I realized like, you know, what a real beating was. And just went from there, man, because I just said, I never looked back. And I thought, man, you know, I want to change my life. You know, I'm you know, I wasn't never actually the type of person that fit in with the drug user scene, right? Like, that wasn't me. It was just, an expression of anger and these things that, you know, in my childhood just kind of, you know, came out the wrong way, right? So it wasn't really like I fit in there.
Right.
So at this point, like I'm really not fitting in anywhere. And this was a quote that I remember where I said, stop trying to find yourself and start to define yourself. And I felt like the whole time I was trying to find myself, and I said, you know, I'm a define who the fuck I am. I'm going to say, this is what I am. And this is what I do. I'm a fighter. Fuck it. Let's go. It's do or die. I've been in jail. I've been dead. I've been, you know, I've slept in the fucking snow. You know what I mean? Like I've been homeless. Like I've done every low thing you can do. Like, what's the worst that could happen? I get knocked out. There's nothing. So, you know, I decided, you know, this is my path and I'm going to carve the path. I'm not going to search for a path. I'm going to make the path and I'm not going to look back and I'm going to the top of that mountain. And that's something I still talk about today. When I talk to people is about, I didn't have any idea how I was going to do it, but I knew why I was going to do it. And I knew that I was going to do it. And I think, in my own personal struggles, and I think in a lot of people's struggles, they kind of get caught up in the how. You know, how am I going to do this? How am I going to win this fight? Whatever. And I think when you understand your why, I think the how becomes a lot more
clear.
Clear, yeah. More clear and easier. I mean, it doesn't matter anymore. It's better to do it 100% wrong than 50% right.
I think there's a balance to doing things, and it's highlighted by what you just said. There's a balance, and it's a lot of what we were talking about earlier about Joel Jameson versus Louis Simmons versus like someone who's like super technical versus someone who's just a fucking mad dog and just wants you to just go out and do it and don't be a pussy.
Mm-hmm.
Your mindset that allowed you to take that fight with no training and then take another fight after that with no training and then take another fight after that with no just this mindset of fuck it, let's just do this. There's a balance between that and then you realizing, okay, I got to really learn how to do this. If I'm going to really be a fighter, I'm going to really be a really define myself, I'm going to really go out and make a mark, I got to learn what the fuck I'm doing.
Exactly.
There's both things there. But that's that balance. Like, you need both things. You know, I mean, it's you have to have a certain amount of fuck it in you. You know, you have to have a certain amount for a sport. I mean, is it called an MMA a sport? It always seemed to me to be. It's too defining. It's too limited. It's not fighting is more than a sport. It's an expression of what you're capable of.
Absolutely.
It's who you are as a human.
And that's where one distinction I've made over the years is the difference between martial skills and martial arts. Everybody always calls everything encompasses it into a martial art. And when we go to the gym and we're training arm bars, do 100 arm bars, that's not an art. That's not your expression of your body in a combat scenario. That's a martial skill. Now, when we go in competition, now we're expressing our art.
Right.
And I think this is an important distinction to be made. I think it's something that I get so tired of hearing, you know, I train martial arts and, you know, I train martial skills and then I express my art.
That's a very interesting way of putting it. How many years after you initially started seriously training were you on The Ultimate Fighter?
4 or 5.
I remember when you were on The Ultimate Fighter and they stole your chew. Somebody fucked with your
chew. That's what everybody remembers, yeah.
Well, I remember that because I remember, like, there's some guys that play tough guy. There's some guys that put on a show and puff up their chest and say some shit that they might not necessarily mean. And then there's some guys that say some shit and you go, uh-oh, this dude's fucking serious. And I remember when they fucked with your chew, I remember watching that and go, this motherfucker's serious. I'm like, Matt Brown's not a joker. And then when you fought Matt Arroyo, that was another example of it. I'm like, there's skill-wise, I'm like, Matt Arroyo's a very talented guy and still is. Good jiu-jitsu guy, good fighter. But there was something, that was a battle of minds.
I agree.
Your mind.
And I don't know if you knew that I fought him before that, too.
Yeah, I did. Right?
Yeah. But the first time I fought, and this is why it was such a no-brainer to say to fight, I fought him the first time on 24 hours notice. So I wasn't training her. I was training a girl, and she was going to Florida to fight. And when I got there, we're driving to the weigh-ins, and the promoter, I heard him talking on the phone, and he goes, and I heard him say, you know, oh, we don't have an opponent for him. So I said, hey, you know, what do you need an opponent for? And he's like, well, this guy, Matt Arroyo, you know, 170. And I said, dude, I'll fight. Like, how much will you pay me? And they're like, yeah, $400, $500. I was like, dude, that'll pay my rent. Fuck yeah, I'll do it. And, and I said, you know, I can't make weight because I got like 1 hour. And, you know, he said, it's cool. And fought him on 25 hours notice and beat him. So he wanted redemption for that.
Yeah. That fight was one of the things about, like, watching you fight is someone who's seen a lot of people fight. There's moments in exchanges where after the exchange, a guy will try to take a break or a guy will try to catch his breath or move a pace.
Obligatory break.
Yeah,
is what I call it. Yeah.
There's little breaks, and then there's guys who recognize those breaks and push in. Mm-hmm. And you're a guy who pushes in.
Absolutely.
When there's a break, you're like, oh, no, motherfucker, there's no breaks here. There's no breaks here. And you just get on, dudes. And it makes things very intense.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing about all your fights. They're very intense. You know, there's a certain level of violence that you bring into the octagon that someone has to be prepared for. You know, and there's some guys that are prepared for it and makes for amazing fights, like your fight with Robbie Lawler. Holy shit, was that a crazy fight.
Yeah.
You know, and then there's guys who just can't keep the pace. They just can't keep that keeping you off of them.
Yeah, and I think my goal as a martial artist, as a fighter, whatever you want to call it, combat guy, you know, I gotta get my skills up to the point where
it matches your mind.
Where it matches the mind, yeah.
And, isn't that crazy?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of guys struggle the other way.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that I talk about a lot that, you see, I don't think that I was necessarily born this way. This is where I think a lot of people get confused. I mean, I was certainly born with an inclination towards fighting. I wouldn't be where I'm at without that. But, you know, I work a lot on my mind. I do a lot of stuff. I've always been obsessed with martial arts and combat as a whole. And I hear other people say they're obsessed. Like Connor, you know, made it really famous when he started saying it, right? I think my obsession goes far, far beyond what anybody's even close to. I don't think their definition of obsession is comparable to mine at all. I mean, I'm far more obsessed. I've read probably I got a library of sports psychology books, of strength and conditioning books, of martial arts books, all this stuff. I mean, it's literally on my mind 24 hours a day. But one of the things I really focus on is the sports psychology part. And I think that is why it's expressed that way in the fight. And you hear a lot of people, they'll say, how have you heard, like, man, you know, my mind's already strong. Like, I ain't scared when I walk in there, or stupid shit like that. And
yeah. And
I always say, you know, do you think Michael Jordan stopped practicing layups? Do you think Jordan Burroughs stopped practicing double legs? Do you think that Arnold Schwarzenegger stopped doing bicep curls? Because it's good doesn't mean that you
can't
stop.
Be improved upon.
Yeah, it can right. be improved upon, and you don't stop. So, and I think the mind is one of those things that can always be better. Like, we're not tapping into, I mean, what are we tapping into? Like 10% of our brains?
That's
at
all bullshit.
Best?
Yeah, that's bullshit. Yeah, they used to think that. They used to think that. That's something they say, but the reality is your brain has a bunch of different quadrants for all sorts of different functions.
Okay.
So when, you know, you're utilizing a certain portion of your brain, that's the portion of your brain that's responsible for those actions.
Okay.
Yeah. This is not.
Either way, our minds are certainly far more unlimited and far more potential than we're tapping into.
Well,
right?
I think your mind is a lot like your body, and it performs and it does what you ask of it. Mm-hmm. And if you just are a lazy bitch who doesn't do anything but sit around and watch TV and you don't ever challenge your mind, I think your mind is weak and it atrophies.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, when you say that you have all these books and you say that you work on your mind, like, do you have a daily practice that you do? Do you meditate? Like, what do you do?
I meditate. You know, daily is sort of a, I hate saying I do it daily because, you know, I skip days.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I have three kids, which, you know how that goes. And yeah it's very, but at the same time, I try to use everything as an opportunity to practice on my mind too, right? How you do anything is how you do everything, right?
Yes.
Right? And so I think, you know, we can use opportunities all the time. And but yes, I do meditate. I do tons of visualization. I have my strength and conditioning coach I work with now. He's also got a degree in sports psychology. So we integrate a lot of that in the training itself. For instance, like we do these 200-yard sprints on the forced treadmill that are just miserable. That, I mean, by the time you're done, you just don't have anything left. It's a complete drain. And then as soon as you're done, like, you have to stand at attention, right? I have to stand, you know, like a military attention, straight up and down, and not let the concept of your body shutting down affect your ability to maintain a posture, right? And that's just a mental thing, 100%, mm-hmm. right? It's sure. solely mental. That's just one example. We do a million things like that. But yeah, I do tons and tons of visualization, which is a consistent marker of high performers, a consistent thing that high performers do. I think this is well known. I have a mental coach specifically that kind of holds me accountable for a lot of the things. You know, me and him, we talk a lot back and forth about the different ways to create habits. I think that's probably the number one thing, is creating habits, right? You know, but, you know, he holds me accountable for everything. And I think that's probably the biggest key, is just being held accountable for every action that you do.
Have you ever used a sensory deprivation tank?
Absolutely. My strength coach has one.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I love it. And I go in about 45 to an hour.
Do you work on shit in there? Do you think about techniques?
You know, I don't really. I use that as a time. So I try to practice this form of meditation that I can't remember the name of it. This dude, Kishnamaru. You ever heard of him? Krishnamaru? I don't know why it's not coming to my head right now, but he was one of Bruce Lee's guys. He's an Indian meditation guy and everything. And his form of meditation was to completely clear your mind, which is, I guess, like, it is actually impossible, right? Like, there's no way to just have no thought at all. But that's sort of what I try to strive for, is go literally no mind at all.
What I do is think about only my breath. That's it. I concentrate on my breathing in and breathing out.
Well,
and there's a bunch of other shit that gets in there, but eventually I can kind of overpower it. and just think only about breathing in, and only about breathing out.
So that's what I do to get to that state, mm-hmm. right? To get to a state where I can release everything.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, once I'm relaxed, then I go for the no mind, which again is impossible. But my personal system of visualization or relaxation is I see the thoughts as clouds, and my mind is a sky or space. So, you know, my mind becomes this gigantic entity, and the thoughts are just clouds that pass by. But again, when I start thinking about things like that, now you're not in the no mind. If you start thinking about your breath, you're not in the no mind.
Right.
And
right.
I want to get as close to that as possible, because in a fight, in a combat situation, I want no mind.
Right.
That's the way that Musashi talks about.
Right. Yeah.
Dude, and that's
Musashi right there.
Oh, fuck yeah.
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 This book was of five rings,
a
man.
Play on Musashi.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Have you read the book Musashi?
Yeah. Yeah, I read that. You put it on your Instagram.
I just
the
put
other
it up every day. Yeah.
I read that, and I read the Book of Five Rings when I was 16. Changed
nice.
My life.
Nice. That's the one that Louis will. If you work for Louis, all of his staff, you're
Louis
forced
Simmons?
To read it. Yeah,
beautiful.
Louis Simmons. You have to read it.
Dude, once you understand the way broadly, you can see it in all things. I remember reading that when I was 16, and I was like, oh, I get it.
Nice.
I was like, when you can get great at something, you can get great at anything. It's the same thing, whether it's playing the piano or writing books or fighting or anything. It's the same thing. It's all about figuring it out, understanding the way.
And that's the book, The Art of Learning. Have you read this one?
No.
Josh Waitzkin, you know his?
Oh, yeah, the chess prodigy that is a black belt under Marcelo Garcia.
A beautiful, amazing book that's sort of a similar type thing.
He's a fucking wizard, man. I've heard him on Tim Ferriss's podcast.
Yep.
Super smart guy.
That's where I heard of him from. Yeah,
genius, and just so good at understanding how to learn things and teach things.
Mm-hmm.
I think that mentality, that chess player mentality, because chess is such a complex, cognitive, demanding game. You know, there's so much thinking and planning and so many steps ahead that you have to be, and so many moves that you have to have cataloged in your head.
You know, and he goes into beyond just the technical part too, when he talks about how he kind of lost his love for it. And it was a great book, man.
Yeah, well, he's a really fascinating character, and I love when a guy like that gets obsessed with martial arts, because it changes the way people look at something like jiu-jitsu. Because people on the outside in particular, they look at jiu-jitsu, it's like, oh, it's just a bunch of fucking meatheads choking each other. And then they see a guy like that and they go, oh, wait a minute, Josh Waitzkin is in jiu-jitsu? He's a black belt? Huh.
Man, that's gotta be one of the great things about jiu-jitsu is the amazing people that do it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you come out here to L.A., and I mean, I see these people doing jiu-jitsu. I talk to them, like, hey, what do you do? Like, oh, you know, I'm a movie top guy or whatever, or I'm executive, or I'm a CEO. Or I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah.
What are you doing in here?
Guy Ritchie. Guy Ritchie's a fucking black belt.
Yeah.
He was on the podcast, and I was like, what? You're a black belt under Henzo?
Right.
I was like, holy shit.
Nice.
Yeah, that's legit, man.
That's badass,
man. Goddamn black belt under Henzo Gracie. They don't give those away.
Maynard James Keenan.
Yep, yep. Oh, he's a buddy of mine.
Yeah. I mean, I know him a little bit.
He's legit as fuck. That dude does jiu-jitsu, and he's got a fake hip.
I didn't know that.
He's got a hip replacement from stomping on stage.
Damn,
you know how he's always stomping on stage?
Didn't he choke someone out on stage?
Yeah, he hip-tossed some dude, took his back, and got him in a rear naked choke on stage and kept singing. And the dude was going like,
nice.
Yes. Like, he wasn't hurting the guy. You know, the guy was a fan. It was, the whole thing was kind of crazy. Like,
is it on YouTube or anything?
Yeah, yeah.
I gotta
Jamie
see
can
this.
Find it. The guy runs up to him on stage. Maynard has the fucking microphone in his hands. Maynard's another dude. He's one of the smartest dudes I know.
So smart.
Stupid smart. To the point where he gets weird around people because he's so goddamn smart. Everybody else is like a baby. So here he's on stage.
You got a big screen.
And some dude jumps onto the stage and rushes him. Where is it at, Jamie? How long is this video? Got to get to when the dude runs on stage.
There he is.
Oh, okay, get it. Go before that because he hip tosses.
And he's
him
like
first.
Singing this whole time.
Look, the guy runs up to him. He's like, "Yeah." Maynard hugs him. Boom.
Nice.
Throws him to the ground. Takes his back. Sings a joke in, and he keeps singing. And then he goes over onto his back and pulls the guy backwards, and then keeps singing while he's in full back mount with the hook. And the dude's got his arms up. Like, yes.
Dude, that is beautiful.
Yeah, and he kept singing the song. This guy's like fucking hilarious.
Man, he's a god, man.
Yeah, he's a bad motherfucker. And he's always training. He comes out here, he trains down. He goes down to Henry Aiken's place and trains with Dave Camarillo, Ralph Gracie. He goes everywhere.
Yeah, I'm training with him a little bit out there. We were drilling a couple weeks ago over at Henry's, and then I brought him to Muscle Farm. We did some training there. And
most people, they get their fucking hip replaced. They're like, that's a wrap.
Right?
Yeah, and he's like, I got to get my black belt. Like, yeah. Wow.
Dude, Mark Coleman had his hip replaced, and he ain't even training.
Yeah.
Didn't he talk about a
both of them, right?
I think he may have had both of them. The one, when had a problem.
Yeah,
had
it got infected.
Redone. Yeah, it got infected, had to get redone.
Redone, man. Imagine that shit. They cut off the top of your leg. They put a fake hip in there. They put a bolt that goes through the center of the bone, all the way down through the bone. Imagine having to redo that. They got to pull it out, put a new one in there. Fuck, man.
Imagine just doing it once. I've only had one surgery in my life. I've only went under. Well, I've went under twice now. So
what'd you have done?
Twice. Yeah, the first one I had tore the ligament right here.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah,
like you were talking about that. That was fucking with you for a long time, right?
Yeah, probably about a year. I fought like that.
Well, you couldn't totally make a fist, right?
Yeah, it was like this, kind of. So I was like frogging people.
Ian McCall's still like that.
Really?
Ian McCall's broke his hand so much that his right hand, one of his knuckles, like his pinky or his pointer finger, it never curls past that.
Yeah, well, this wasn't broken. The bones were all intact, but the ligament there was completely torn.
So what'd they have to do?
They just went in. There's an incision there and just reattached the ligament. And I came back probably 4 months later, 5 months later, maybe. That's when they were telling me you'll be fine and everything. And, you know, it took probably a year before it was actually okay.
Wow.
It's just...
Chris Weidman's going through some shit like that right now. He fucked his thumb up in the Kelvin Gastelum fight and then had to get a ligament from his wrist taken out and attached to his thumb because his thumb's ligament was torn. And he still can't fully train, still can't grip or fully punch. Yeah, he's waiting.
Yeah, mine, they didn't have to do none of that. But they said once they opened it up, there was a lot more stuff in there they had to take out and a lot more that was ripped that they didn't even realize was there. You know how it is with the MRIs. Yeah.
Well, with fighters, like so many guys have shit wrong. They don't even know. Like, did you ever see Jacare's when they had his elbows cleaned out?
No.
He had elbow surgery, and they found chunks of bone and cartilage in his elbow, like a shot glass filled with like shit that was floating around inside of his elbow, just from hitting people with elbows and getting armbarred and not tapping and shit popping and snapping and tearing loose, and all of it is just fucking mangled.
Yeah, because he broke his arm when he's
Hodger.
Hodger, right?
Yeah, Hodger going. Broke his arm and he tucked it into his belt and kept going.
It's badass. And,
I mean, that was a horrible arm break, too.
Like, to me, wrestling is the hardest sport in the world, and I love wrestling. I love watching it. I love being a part of it.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen in wrestling.
Right.
Very often. I mean, I guess there's probably some. I know Mike Pasillo went to the finals with a torn pec.
Wow.
Yeah. So one
takes
arm,
a lot. Takes a lot.
I guess
it
does happen in wrestling. I shouldn't say that. Yeah,
that's a different.
Yeah, never mind.
That situation was just he was up on points and he just needed to survive for a couple
minutes.
He won
the match, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Won the match. Man. Well, you remember when John Jones fought Vitor? Vitor completely hyperextended his arm. That
Did
was
it break?
When I don't know if it broke, but it was fucked up for a long time. I mean, it was bent like this the other way, just completely bent backwards. Like, I was convinced he was going to tap. I was like, he's got to tap.
I thought he was, too.
And Vitor, like, let it go a little.
Yeah.
It looked like he let it go. It was weird.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and
think of if he finishes that.
Crazy.
The
world changes.
Yeah, the whole world of light heavyweight changes.
Yeah.
Vitor's life changes.
Yeah, everything changes. Vitor becomes a champ. Yeah. The whole thing changes.
John Jones, not the greatest ever.
Yeah.
Which, is up in the air or whatever. But
I think he's the greatest ever performance-wise. We were talking about performance-wise earlier before the podcast started versus, like, we were talking about Cain Velasquez. Performance-wise, like, the actual results versus what you think about their ability. You know, I think Cain, when he was at the time, I never saw anybody like Cain when he was in his prime. 240 pounds, unfucking godly cardio. We just never stop coming at you. Excellent striking technique, take a tremendous shot.
My whole thing with it, though, is As soon as you test positive once, I take you out of the greatest, period.
Right.
It's just against the rules. I'm not even against steroids. Like, take steroids. You know, like, if it's your endocrinologist tells you to take steroids, go fucking do it. Good. Good for you. But in our sport, unfortunately, it's against the rules, so there's only a certain amount of people doing it. So if you're doing it, you're cheating.
Right.
And
but do you think John was taking steroids?
I don't know.
I don't think he was.
But to be honest, it doesn't matter
right.
to me. I mean, you know, I've said this for a long time. I think it should be a lifetime ban, first offense,
really?
Period. Yeah. And there's going to be martyrs. There would be guys like, I don't think Tim Means was taking steroids. Like,
he wasn't.
He certainly did not look like it.
They proved it. They proved that he wasn't.
Oh, really? I didn't know it went that far. Okay, so.
They found the supplement that he was taking that was a totally legal supplement.
Okay.
You get a bunch of shit from these companies that get it from China, and they have these bins. And, like, we had a problem with that with the Alpha Brain when we first had, not steroids, but vitamins that were in Alpha Brain that weren't supposed to be in there.
That weren't supposed to be there.
We have all our stuff independently tested, and when we had it independently tested, it turned out that the mixers that when they were putting all the different ingredients in, they would be putting in these vats, and they had used these vats for other shit and had it completely cleaned it out. This is a problem with companies that sell steroids and also sell things like creatine. Like, this is the big story about John Jones. This is the big rumor. This is what they think, is that he was doing coke that had creatine in it.
Yeah, I heard
it was
this.
Cut with creatine,
yeah.
And that creatine probably had trace elements of steroids. The reason why that makes sense is because he tested negative right before that test, and then tested positive, and then tested negative again a short time after that. This is a steroid that takes several months to get out of your system, but it got out of his system very quickly, which would indicate it was a very, very small trace amount. Not an amount that you would take if you were actually using it to try to, you know, to get a performance-enhancing benefit. That's what I believe. Okay. It makes sense to me. And
yeah,
so it makes sense to Nowitzki, too.
It's fair enough. And I'm certainly there's cases. So in my world where, okay, first offense, lifetime ban, I think a lot of guys would be a lot more careful with things like that, for one. And I think, you know, there would be a due process. So, you know, say he proved that, or like Tim Means, you know, proved it.
Right.
You know, he comes right back, right? And I also think, unfortunately, there would be people that would probably have no bad intention and would have the, you know, end up testing positive and having a lifetime ban. And there would be martyrs, basically. And
I can't sign off on martyrs, man. Too many dudes have dreams, you know.
For sure,
like,
for sure.
What about you? Like, what if you accidentally took some creatine and had some bullshit in it?
Personally, I'm extremely diligent. I do my, you know,
right.
I do my due diligence, man. Like, I work with Muscle Farm for years now, and like, I know that.
And they have great stuff.
Yeah, they have great stuff. I know that it's good stuff, and that's my primary supplement source. I don't go do coke. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
If you do those things and something bad happens to you, that's your fault. You know what I mean? If for instance, he was doing coke and, you know, not a knock on John Jones either. I mean, I'm not living his life. I mean, he's in a difficult situation as a young kid. You know, I can only imagine the amount of people approaching him for crazy things and trying to talk him into all these things. So I have some sympathy for his situation, but, you know, you make the choice, you have to pay the consequences for the choice.
I agree that you should pay the consequences for the choice. I just don't agree that the price should be so high. No. You know, like when you think about a guy like Anderson Silva, just tested positive again.
Again.
Do you think that that takes him out of the consideration for the greatest of all time?
In my mind, 100%.
See, I feel like he's doing it because he's old. I feel like he's doing it because he's 40.
So we can feel whatever we want to feel, right?
I
mean, I feel like he probably wasn't doing it the whole time.
But he might have been.
Yeah, but do I know?
Yeah.
Hell no, I don't know.
Did you ever see his trainer?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he trained Eric Silva when I fought him. And, you know,
his trainer looks ridiculous. Yeah. He's set like 70 years old. He's just fucking jacked. Yep. It just looks like the Hulk.
He's got like 5% body fat at 60 years
he's
old.
He's so big. Like, I sent a picture of the guy to Dana, and I go, "This is Anderson's trainer, LOL." And Dana sends me back, "Holy shit, are you serious?" I go, "Yeah, that's his trainer."
Oh,
the
man.
Fucking guy's so jacked.
Dana's certainly seen him around the UFC. Yeah. He's trained lots of guys.
Is that's
not
that's
him.
A different guy, man.
Unless he's younger.
He's the guy above it with the white shirt. That guy.
No.
Yeah, that guy right there.
Okay, yeah. But that's him. Look at the picture to the left.
Left is the one. Yeah, that's the picture I sent Dana. He's so jacked. I mean, his fucking abs stick out like biceps. Each one of his abs looks like a bodybuilder's bicep just glued to his stomach. That guy's so jacked.
Oh, that's great.
Listen, folks. There's like... You can get big at 60. You could be pretty built at 60. You can't be that built. It's not possible.
It's like 0.01% of the population that can do that, maybe.
Yeah, and they all live in Africa.
Yeah.
They all have like super genes.
Yeah.
You know, they're all like Francis Ngannou's relatives. There's so few people that are built like that naturally.
Oh, that's just good, man.
Not at that age. You know, at that age, you know, your body starts to diminish. There's just no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Do you know that he's that old for sure?
Yeah, that guy's old.
Yeah?
Yeah, he's in his 60s. Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah.
I think he's an ex-gym, right? Is that his... I know he trained Eric Silva, who was at X-Gym. He was in his corner, and you know, I was like, I'm glad I'm fighting a little guy, not him.
Yeah, Eric Silva changed. Boy, you want to talk about a post-USADA guy.
Yeah.
Like, he's one of him and Vitor, but Vitor obviously was a testosterone replacement therapy. But
him and I think Johnny Hendricks was probably the most obvious, right?
Performance-wise, for sure. You got to wonder about Hendricks, like how much of it was burnout, how much of it was... Possibly he was taking something. You got to say it possibly because he never tested positive for anything. But,
absolutely, yeah.
But, dude, he was launching people across the
octagon. I was the last fight before USADA when I fought him. You know, I felt his strength. I seen his body. I mean, you know, I felt it firsthand. You know, this is a completely different world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, especially completely different compared to now. He doesn't look the same.
Yeah.
He doesn't fight the same. It's like...
Certainly part of that has to be motivation, too. I mean, he's just... There's no way he's under the same mental aspiration that he had before. He just looks at it differently.
Could be also because his hormones are all fucked up.
Absolutely.
This is a big speculation. If he was on something and then he's off, his hormones crash.
Yep.
There's no way they can't. That's just how
it
works.
And that affects your mind, right?
100%.
I mean, 100%. I've never taken it, but I mean, I see people that go on and off of it, and they're like depressed. And
look at Vitor. Remember when Vitor came back? I mean, there's so many pictures of Vitor when he fought like Michael Bisping, and then you see Vitor after USADA, and he's got that old man bod, and he goes in there, and his body's kind of like loose, and it just your body's not producing hormones anymore. Vitor was on that shit when he was 19, man.
Oh, was he? Well, yeah, I guess, yeah. Yeah.
I don't know why. When he fought Randy and he was 240 pounds and his neck started up here, his neck started about 2 inches above his ears and just went down straight to his shoulders. Fucking.
He's so fast. It's like
ridiculously fast. Yeah, especially when he fought Tank. Well, when he was about 205, he was ridiculously fast.
Yeah, because I wonder if there's any, I was going to say, like, If you slow down when you stop taking that stuff, like if your muscles actually, you know, your fast twitch muscles go away or something
your whole body crashes.
Right.
When you're that jacked up on steroids, your whole body, first of all, your balls are just like on vacation.
I mean, I know you get stronger, but what about, you know, speed, though? That's a different thing. A lot of speed is from a neurological, right? It's a lot of, you know, the nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder... You know, about the effects. Did you see the study Andy Galpin just came out with?
Which one?
He just posted it the other day about epigenetic memory of muscles.
Yes.
So this is, I think, a big problem with the steroids because I say I do steroids when I'm 19. Now my muscles get jacked, and now my muscles remember how to get that jacked again. Even though I'm off steroids for 10 years, and then I come back at 30 and redo it.
That's a very good point. And a very real point. Yeah, your body has muscle memory, and especially if you do it when you're young, and then your body has an adequate amount of time to rebuild, and you start developing a natural hormone level. That also increases your tendon strength. It increases ligament strength. I mean, your body changes. It changes the density of your muscles or of your bones. It just does. There's a lot of bet. I mean, and then there's another argument for women that have taken steroids. It's an even more intense argument because you're putting supernatural levels of testosterone in a woman's body. They develop all this new muscle tissue that never would have been there without it. And a certain amount of that sticks around.
Mm.
And, you know, you might not have ever been able to develop that kind of strength without it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that was the first thing I thought of when I seen that study.
Yeah.
And that was where I was like, you know, there's always a lot more to it than than meets the eye.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, and, you know, with the kind of cheating that they've been doing in Russia, you know, did you see that movie Icarus?
No, it's on Netflix, right?
Yeah.
I know what you're talking about. I want to see it.
It's fucking crazy.
I just watch so little TV. I just miss everything.
Yeah.
Every day someone, did you see this on Netflix? Nah, I planned on it. It's on my queue.
It'll make you curious and mad at the same time.
Really?
Because they had a state-sponsored doping program. Russia had all of their
athletes cheating.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's pretty well known, right? I mean,
yeah, but this was proven.
So the guy who was doing it.
The guy who was doing it is in this documentary, and he was helping this guy, Brian Fogel, do a bike race. What Brian Fogel did was he did a bike race with nothing, and then he wanted to get juiced up and see what the difference is with the next year, do the same race, but do it on everything. And so he contacted this Russian guy who is the head of anti-doping in Russia. Well, this guy, along the way, from doping up Brian Fogel, they all got busted. And when they got busted, not Brian Fogel, the Olympics in Russia, they had the Sochi Olympics. They found out that people had tampered with samples, and a bunch of shit started coming out about it, and then it became this gigantic scandal. He fled Russia, came to the United States, and testified and told everything that he did. They opened up these supposedly unopenable sample jars and replaced the bad urine with clean urine. They had frozen urine, and then they had a hole in the wall where they were passing urine back forth and replacing the old stuff with
clean
stuff.
Was this specific to a certain specific sport?
No, every sport. Across the board. Whew. And they had a record number of gold medals that year. Whew. Everybody's juiced to the tits. And everybody's pissing clean.
That's the tough thing about everybody goes into the Russian training methods and how they're superior and everything. And you're like, well,
a little bit of that, a little bit of this. Yeah. I mean, there's some great Russian training methods for sure. I mean, the Russians absolutely invented the kettlebells. Russians have super technical wrestling instruction, and there's some, without a doubt, some great Russian training methods. But it's also because sports means so much to them.
Yeah,
on
I was
a national
say,
level.
Like they're also state sponsored scientists rather than, you know, in America where it's, you know, if you're a professor or something, you just do what you want to do for your, you know, for your athletes or whatever.
Well, we have to realize that their best athletes are all amateurs.
Yeah.
They don't have professional sports.
Boxing.
Yeah, but that's it. I mean, and they don't have, well, they have MMA too, Fedor, obviously, right? Mm-hmm. But they don't have like NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, hockey.
They don't have like this professional
venue like we do over here. So a lot of their greatest athletes go into amateur Olympics. Mm. And so they're juicing these fucking people up for Soviet glory. They're doing it for the glory of the country.
Right.
And it's sponsored by the state. And they outline in this documentary from Putin all the way down, people working for Putin, who this guy, this Grigory guy, who is the guy who was in charge of all the state-sponsored doping. It's fucking madness. And it makes you wonder. You know, I mean, nobody wants to say, like, Fedor in Pride was the motherfucker, right? I mean, he was the motherfucker.
Loved it.
An animal. And it makes you wonder. It makes you wonder, like, what was going on over there?
Well, loved it, man.
Yeah.
That was one of the best. I think Krokop Fedor.
Woo!
Man, that was, like, for me, it was probably, like, the most intense. I had to stay up for it.
Yeah.
And I just remembered waiting, watching him walk out, just eyes.
Those are like at 3 o'clock in the morning,
out.
Right?
Yeah, I remember it was really late at night. I remember it was snowing and shit.
Fuck.
I don't know why I remember that, but like I was sad, like, I'm not fucking going anywhere, man. I'm sitting here watching this, eyes bulging out, just, you know, I didn't care, man.
Yeah, Fedor versus Nogueira.
It's so rare that fights are like that anymore. I mean, there's certainly some
that
come up here and there, but. Man, those to me were the glory days, man.
Yeah,
we waited how long to see the fight?
Yeah,
you know, it's like 3-4 months. There's no fights in between,
right?
You know, there's like one UFC fight or something, and we're just like, dude, this is the fight. This is the Super Bowl that everybody's been waiting the whole season for.
Do you think there's too many fights now?
I don't know.
I like it. I like that there's a lot of fights.
Yeah,
but I also think that some of them get overlooked.
Absolutely, absolutely, and like I wish. There's a side of me that wishes it was the way it was back in the day, and there's a side of me that's like, dude, this is what we all wanted from the beginning.
Right.
You know, we wanted fights every weekend. But, unfortunately, it does take away from that gigantic fight.
Yeah.
You know, those are harder to make these days,
I think.
And I think that's why they're doing the champ versus champ thing. They're trying to make those big fights again.
Yeah, I think so too. But if you only have those fights every 3 or 4 months, there's no way you're going to have enough fights for all the athletes in the UFC.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's
a
big part of the issue is there's 500 fighters on roster. Plus, I think there's more now, actually.
The only thing I mean, I'm no one to say how to do it, but I kind of wish there was like a, you know, the UFC fight night and then the pay-per-view and, you know, they have all these different things, but they don't seem to, I mean, I think they may be moving towards it where there's sort of a, you know, the smaller fights work up, like you do like a UFC fight night 3 or 4 times, build an audience, now we put you on pay-per-view for the big fight. You get what I'm saying? Something like this, like not necessarily like a feeder, but, you know, within the organization, a feeder.
Yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
More structured.
I mean, I love the big events that they have every year, like the 4th of July event, the New Year's event, the Madison Square Garden event. They have a year where they just stack it and just have just a ton of big-time fights. But, you know, like, I liked Eric Anders, Lyoto Machida last week, too, you know? I mean, I like that, too, where it's maybe a fight that not a lot of people are watching, maybe less people are watching, but it's an interesting fight still.
Yeah, I didn't get to watch it. I don't have cable anymore, so.
You don't?
Yeah. Don't even have cable. Like, we use Netflix, my wife does.
But do you honestly have the UFC app?
I do have the UFC app. Was it on there?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't, but it probably will be. How long after?
Yeah, it will be.
How long do they wait before from Fox Sports 1 till it's on the UFC app?
I don't even know. I mean, that's the thing, though, is I sit there and watch that. If I'm watching anything, it's always fights on there or YouTube. I just watch Muay Thai fights all day. That's, like, my favorite thing to do.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Did you see Sanchez's latest?
The question mark kick?
Yeah. Ooh, dude.
Where he got pulled up his shorts right after he did it, too. This guy, man.
He's
I love him.
He's wild, man.
I love him.
Sanchai is so interesting to me because he's different than any other Thai fighter in his movements. He's so light on his feet, constantly switching stances, and he's just...
He's a Floyd Mayweather of Muay Thai.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, that's a guy I'm going to try to get out here for... You know, like what I'm doing with Muscle Farm is some things I could try to help them build a team and everything. And he's one of the guys I want to get out for a seminar and kind of be, affiliate with him.
Please let me know.
Yeah,
I want to meet that guy.
Yeah, I really want to get him because it's not just the way that he fights in the ring, but the way that he trains, man.
Yeah.
He trains hard.
Hard.
You know, you watch his videos of him, you're like, dude. And it's so easy for him. That's the weird part, right? Like, I mean, he'll do like 30 kicks in a row.
Yeah.
Like, dude, how did you just do that? And you're like smiling.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't kick like...
He's loose, man.
Yeah.
So loose.
He's not loose like hits. A Liam Harrison guy that is... Every kick is fucking 150%. He's like, pop, 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 pop. And he just keeps going.
His eyes, man. I don't know if it's something you can even train. I mean, he's like I'd say more like the Lomachenko of Muay Thai, right?
Yeah.
Where his eyes, man, he just sees.
Yeah.
Like that question mark kick. Yep. I mean, he just knows.
Yeah, there he is.
Yeah.
And you look at his body, man, and he ain't a scary, impressive guy. Like you look at Bukow. Bukow's jacked, you know, giant fucking ab muscles, just ripped. Sanchai just looks like a guy who works out a little bit.
<That's> so true.
But meanwhile, he just fucks people up, man. And he's so slick with his movement. Like, even when he's hitting the pads, who hits pads like this where he never stops moving his feet.
So relaxed.
So relaxed and so fluid. What's interesting to me is the feet. Just never stops moving his feet. And that's just, I don't understand why more people don't emulate his style. Because he's obviously a traditionally trained Thai fighter, but has adapted everything to a much more dynamic and fluid method.
Man, it's like, you know, when I watch Sanchai and Lomachenko, I watch the shit out of these guys, right?
Mm.
And so I watched Liam Harrison, right? Or John Wayne Parr, Raymond Deckers, you know, these great Muay Thai guys, right? And they inspire me. I'm like, dude, I want to fucking do it. And then I watch Sanchai, I watch Lomachenko. I'm like, why do I do this?
Right.
It's the next level. Why am I even going to the gym? I can't.
Like, look at this.
I can't do this.
Bop, bop,
bop, yeah, that's what bop, I'm talking about right there.
And so fluid. And
just relax.
Look at him. He's not even getting tired.
I mean, look at his face. He doesn't even. I mean, he could do this
all day.
All day, and I mean, he could do it in his kitchen while he's cooking. You know,
and he's 36.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really incredible. He's something special.
That's the most the most facial expression I've ever seen on him right there.
Yeah, it's probably the end smiling. Of 150 rounds at the end of the day.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy's constantly training, constantly in the gym. And one of the things that I like about the way the Thai spar, too, is that they play.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're tapping each other.
Yep.
They're just working on their timing and their movement, and they're not hurting each other. They're saving it for fights.
Yeah, well, they fight every week.
Yeah.
My coach, Dorian Price, he's over there right now. And
yeah.
I mean, they fight all... Every week, man.
I follow him on Instagram.
Oh, nice. Yeah, he's a
bad motherfucker. Amazing, I like watching
that guy
fight.
Person, man. Just one of the best guys you'll ever meet in your life, man.
I like one of the things he said recently. He's like, "Yeah, I'm wearing the same gray T-shirt and the same shorts." He goes, "I'm not here for a fucking fashion show. I'm here to train. I'm in Thailand. Yeah, it's hot as hell.
For
I'm
you.
Here to get my work in."
Yeah, and he goes over to Holland with Ryan Simpson and. Another guy I hope to get over here, too.
He was showing on one of his Instagram posts, he was like, "These are my 5-star accommodations. He had a white plastic bucket. This is how I shower." You know, like, he's over there doing the real deal, real Thai fighter.
Yep. So that's where he actually goes up to, I don't think he still goes up there, but he used to go up to Asan, which is the northern part of Thailand. And originally, they didn't let foreigners up there. He would go to Sitmanchai. He was the first foreigner that they let in that camp. And that was his dream. He wanted to live like a TIE fighter.
Wow.
Like a savage. And
that's awesome.
That's where I'm lucky to have a friend like him, because he brings the TIE style back to me. And that's why I've never had to go to Thailand. Like, he goes over, he'll only come back for my camps. He's had tons of people offer, and he won't come back for no one else.
That's awesome.
He's been, so when I was telling you a story about going, you know, started this Japanese jiu-jitsu place, the first gym I went into, he was there.
Wow.
And, you know, we both... started together, and he wanted. Well, he'd already started, actually. He was out in Virginia, and then just moved to Columbus. But we both wanted to do Muay Thai, and I was like, "Dude, there's no money in Muay Thai. You do that shit." And, so he went to Muay Thai, and I went with MMA. Of course, he went with MMA for a little while. And,
dude, I wish there was money in Muay Thai. I love watching Lion Fight.
I love
watching it, and I preferred that even over regular kickboxing. I like the elbows.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah, I just
why they limit it?
Yeah, why limit it? I think they limited it for K1 because they thought it would create more action with less clinching. But
it's garbage.
It is, right? It's part of the
art. I mean,
not
garbage.
It's not
garbage. Say that,
I still enjoy watching Bellator kickboxing. I love Glory because they just have some wild ass fights. But a lot of those guys that are the top of the food chain guys are Muay Thai guys.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin Ross is in Bellator now. I mean, this guy elbow the shit
out
of everybody.
John Wayne.
Yeah,
Joe Schilling.
I mean, these are elbow guys.
Yeah, elbow guys.
Man, I've always thought that if they marketed Muay Thai like they do the kickboxing, I think it would blow up a lot better. But when you take Muay Thai, like Lion Fights, and they're playing the Snake Charmer music, and they got the Mong Kongs, and they're dancing around Y Kruin and shit, and everybody's like, "Dude, I don't want to see this garbage. I want to see some fucking blood."
Yeah, it's hard for people to appreciate the tradition, but I don't, you know. I respect their tradition. You know what someone explained
to
me? They said that what's beautiful about the Mong Kong and the Y Crew is that you get relaxed. It's like you're out there dancing, and then you can put on your best performance because you're already in front of all those people, and you kind of loosen up. And then doing that, that's one of the benefits of that.
Personally, I love it. I think it's awesome, and I'll watch it all day long. But I don't think the casual American fan is ever going to be attracted to that.
I wonder. You know, I wonder if they could be talked into it. It just seems like... What happened with MMA was like lightning in a bottle. That Forrest Griffin, Stephen Bonner fight on TV, on Spike TV, nobody knew what the fuck it was at the time. You're watching MMA for the first time, you see that crazy shit. These guys are just throwing down wild haymakers and head kicks and takedowns and then exhausted. I mean, these guys just drain themselves out. I think those guys made the UFC. I think in that one fight, it's one of those weird moments. Lightning in a bottle. You know, at one point in time, they estimate there was as many as 10 million people watching that fight.
Really?
And it started with just a couple of million. Like, the event started with just
everybody's
a couple million people.
Their friends.
Yes,
dude,
exactly.
You gotta watch this.
Dude, these guys are fucking going crazy. And that one fight being so good, I think, made MMA. I think it just was the launching point. And then after that, people got into it, and then they started saying, "Holy shit, this is awesome." And then all the other fights, and then it became the thing that it is today. But I think that lightning in a bottle moment, it's hard to recreate. And with Muay Thai, it just never happened. There's no lightning in a bottle moment. And I don't know how you would recreate that today. It seems like all the stars were aligned, right? Because now today, reality TV shows are kind of they're so saturated. There's so many of them. Back then, there wasn't as many. So to have the Ultimate Fighter, we got these guys in a house, and they're all competing, and they're going to fight for this six-figure contract on television. It was a big deal. It was a big show to watch. But now it's like everybody's watching people fucking selling cars and pawn shops, and they're living in the woods, and people are making moonshine. It's like, fuck, man. There's so many reality shows. It's almost oversaturated to the point where if you had a Muay Thai show, it's like, well, okay, here's another crazy thing people are doing. Oh, this guy's living with bears.
Well, they did. That contender, that Muay Thai contender.
That's right. They did, right. Did that even air here?
I watched it.
Did it air in America?
Yeah. I don't know how I watched it. Maybe on YouTube or something.
Because the Contender here was a boxing show, right?
Yeah, but they had the Contender Muay Thai also.
Was it called the Contender Asia? Is that what it was called?
Yeah, I don't remember. I remember John Wayne Parr was on it, Yotes and Clyde.
Right.
I don't remember it that well.
There's another bad motherfucker, Yotes and Clyde. Holy shit. Right.
He just came back.
Did he? Mm-hmm. Oh, he retired for a little bit, right?
Yeah, he just fought, I think, last weekend maybe. Or something
man.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, to me, it's one of the great unsung combat sports. And, you know, all these people that are watching boxing, and I love boxing. But, you know, if HBO just really wanted to get down and dirty, come on, HBO, show me some Muay Thai.
That'd be
just
the shit.
Push it.
That would be so amazing.
Have Sanchai on. Can you imagine?
Or maybe ESPN, you know, instead of having these commentators, these narrators that are just dipshits, and you know, every time they talk about MMA, I almost vomit. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And then, you know, instead of these garbage shows they have golf, you know? I mean, some of the, they have like a darts. I've seen fucking darts on ESPN, but you can't show a kickboxing match. Come on.
Well, you know what, man? I think there's a problem with commentary with sports that leaks into MMA, and I don't think it belongs there. And I've fought against it from the beginning, and that's the insult commentary. There's a kind of like calling people bums and calling people losers, and, you know, and get out of the game.
Snoop Dogg, that piece of shit. Call him out.
What don't you like about Snoop Dogg?
He called Connor. Mary called him a bitch.
That was a mess. That was a mess.
That's not cool, man.
Mayweather fight. That was a mess. I think he was fucked up.
I don't care.
Yeah.
You know, he put it on public. He could have, you know, apologized, deleted, whatever. You know.
Yeah.
If I go to the UFC PI, I might just punch him if I see him there.
Whoa.
I'm cool with that.
Look out, Snoop. You don't want none of that, Snoop.
Hey. I'm just saying, that really offends me, man, because you know what, man? Connor, you know, people all have their opinions about him. I respect the shit out of that guy. I love what he's done. I love his shtick. I think he's a true sportsman. I mean, I like it. He comes into the limelight for a little while, and then he goes back, and I think he goes back, and he works his ass off.
Yeah.
I really think he does.
Well, he definitely does.
Yeah,
he wouldn't
be where he's at if he didn't, right?
Yeah.
You know, but everybody judges him by, you know, what he does out here.
Well,
but
listen, what he did was make $100 million fighting against the greatest boxer of all time for his first professional boxing match. And did well.
Did well.
Yeah, and won a couple of rounds, which is fucking crazy. Yeah. You know, that's fucking crazy.
Right. I mean, I think Floyd...
took off.
I think the vast majority of people could, of good fighters, could win rounds against Floyd. Just because Floyd, I don't know if I'd say gives him away, but... You know, he's going to feel you. That's the way he fights. He fought everybody like that. You know? And he rarely wins the first few rounds.
Agreed.
Yeah.
But
that's not taking away nothing from Connor, though.
He didn't want to get clipped by that left uppercut. That wasn't on his plans.
You're right. Yeah.
I just think what I'm talking about is like the commentators and a lot of the journalists. And you see less of it today because
Stephen A. Smith.
Yeah, that kind of style. Yeah. There's a style, and this is their shtick. Their shtick is mocking people and creating controversy. Yeah. And that's why I say I don't think MMA is a sport. I think it's more intense. You're emptying out there. You know, when you see a fight, you know, and it's a crazy ass war like Robbie Lawler, Rafael Dos Anjos, where it's just five rounds of chaos. To diminish either one of these guys as a man, as a human being, based on their performance, to mock them or belittle them, I just don't think it has any place in that. I think it's a way more intense and way more personal experience for those guys. It's not playing baseball. It's not It's not fucking Bill Buckner dropping a ball. It's not. That's not what it is, man. It's way more intense. If you got a guy who's a lazy football player who doesn't run fast enough, you want to mock him, that's whatever. You go ahead and do that. I don't care. It doesn't bother me. But you want to make fun of a guy who's literally putting his health on the line in an occupation where you're competing against a motherfucking trained killer, and you guys are going to throw bones at each other for five-minute rounds. You got to have some respect. You have to have respect, or you shouldn't be talking about it. You should have some understanding of it. You should know what the fuck you're watching, and you should have some respect. And if you want to say that a guy should retire, if you want to say that a guy has probably seen his better days, that's fine. But have some respect. This is a different thing, man. It is not a regular sport.
I agree. And I think I would say also that they have no right to be saying things that they've never done, right?
Yeah.
I mean you just can't – you don't have to compete, right? Like you do jiu-jitsu and Muay Thai and shit, and like you get such a more in-depth knowledge about what they're truly going through, right, and what's happening by just experiencing it a little bit, right?
There's that, and there's also – I think if you've never really been punched in the face and you're talking about guys getting punched in the face, like you really don't even understand the experience.
Or if you never – even worse, I mean, you've been never been punched in the face and there's nothing you can do about it. Like you've been,
right.
You've been, I mean, the worst I ever had, I went down to Cuba for a little while and I trained with the Olympic boxing team down
there.
When
did you do this?
2012, I think.
Yeah?
I think it,
yeah. What was, how did this come about? Was it even legal to go down there back then? Did you go on a raft? How did you get down there?
I think I'm past the... what would they call
statute
it?
Statute of limitations.
Statute of limitations. It's actually illegal to spend money there. So I didn't spend any money there. But I went there, and I guess it's not illegal to actually go there. So we went through Mexico City. You go to Mexico City, then you buy a flight in Mexico City and you go
wow.
over there. One of my coaches I worked with for a long time on and off is a Cuban, and he grew up there. And we went there together. He's a part of the – he used to coach the wrestling team. So I went there and trained with the wrestlers. For 6-8 weeks, and we'd go over to the boxing team every now and then. Well, I went with one guy. He was a 2-time gold medalist, I think, and I've never seen boxing like that in my life. I mean, I've never felt anything, and there's nothing I could do, nothing. I mean, I tried every fucking trick in the book. I tried every athletic move. I'd hands up, hands down, hands aside, whatever, nothing. I mean, I've never seen boxing. And I mean, 2-time gold medalist. I mean, he was an amazing, amazing boss. I can't remember his name or anything, but, and, you know, just never experienced anything like it. And it was the same with the wrestlers. I mean, I went with some guys that I got to go with Mihan Lopez. He's a heavyweight, of course, Greco. I don't know if you know who he is, but greatest Greco next to Carolyn, rivaling Carolyn in the greatest ever. I went with this guy, Ivan Fundor, who you had been asking last week. He was a guy who I think he was the guy that Askren couldn't get past for the Olympics. And I know that Fundor beat him, but he teched him. So, you know, Askren's, you know, as amazing as he is, I mean, that's how much better Fundor is.
Yeah, to explain teched him for people, was it 15 points?
I don't know what it is in international, actually. I thought it was like 9 or 10, but whatever. You gotta get way ahead of someone.
Yeah.
I mean, he worked him over. So I got to work with these just amazing guys. But the boxing, you know, that's what we're talking about. And I mean, I've literally to experience like this guy is punching you, and there's nothing you can do.
Yeah,
nothing. You don't have. We're in a little ring, and I mean, you don't have a choice. So you can get out of the ring, or you can get punched. That's your only choice.
Just getting boxed up.
Boxed up. And I mean, and he's moving, you know, like Sanchai, relaxed and chilled. And he's like, what do you want? You know, you gonna fucking do something or what?
Wow. I mean,
not talking to me like that, but.
But doing it with his motions.
Yeah. Terrible. But yeah. What an amazing place, though, man. You know, I feel really bad for those people. What an experience, man. Just a different world. You feel like you're going back in the 50s.
Where'd you eat over there? How do you eat?
So we stayed with Ivan Fundor, and his wife would actually cook for us every day. But there's restaurants and stuff too. I mean, it's like a dollar or two. And we went to this one place just about every day. They'd serve a big bowl of spaghetti, like this big around and this big, just a gigantic bowl for like a dollar.
Wow.
Had chicken on top. They don't really have red meat. I guess it's only for the wealthy or for the top people. I don't know if it's illegal or something, but what, to witness the LeVon Lopez, who we stayed with originally, so to witness the way they live was really fascinating. Because so in their wrestling dorms, they have it's like six stories high. We had to walk to the bottom to get a 5-gallon bucket of water to take a bath. They had no running water upstairs. Take a bath. That's how you brush your teeth. That's how you do everything. The guys on the top floor are the first level, first team, the varsity team, so to speak. You know, the first level guys. They get four meals a day, and they get air conditioning in their room. The guys right below them, the second team, they got three meals a day and no air conditioning.
Whoa.
So these guys are literally fighting for their food and for you know, for the next level. And I mean, I've seen fights break out. I've seen guys trying to hurt each other in the wrestling room. I mean, it's fucking intense day in, day out, man.
They have some incredible genetics over there too.
Incredible.
That's, you look at a guy like Yoel Romero. That motherfucker looks like he was made in a lab somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Like some scientists just spliced together all the perfect attributes.
And just to be clear, like, don't quote me on that. Like, that's kind of how I heard through, you know, like translation. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? So I maybe if I got something wrong, I don't want some, you know, a bunch of Cubans trying to beat me up for quoting it wrong or anything. But what is, like I said, it's an amazing place, man. And those guys are just, they're fighting for their food, man. And I seen one kid. He was the cousin of LeVon Lopez. LeVon's a bronze medalist and probably should have been gold medalist. You know, I don't want to. The Olympics have a lot of kind of behind the scenes stuff that people don't know about.
Yeah,
that I'm not sure if I'm really at liberty to speak out about in public. You know,
because it's rumors, right?
No, there's facts.
Like what?
There's certainly facts. Well, like I said, I'm not sure that I can really talk about it in public. I wouldn't want to hurt any of those guys. But, you know, his cousin came from Pinar del Rio, which we went out there one day, and that was that is a good story. So we go out to Pinar del Rio. It's like 2 hours from Havana, and we took a donkey cart to a fucking farm in the middle of nowhere. We go back probably 5-6 acre farm. We walk back through this horse field, walking over shit and everything. And then there's a, I'll show you all these pictures of this too. It's fascinating. And there's a forest. And as soon as you walk through the forest, now it's a casino in the middle of a forest. So I guess all this shit's illegal. There's cockfights, chicken fights in the fucking middle of the woods.
Wow.
Which is illegal in Cuba. So I got
Cockfights are illegal?
Yeah. So I got you know, experience illegal chicken fights in an illegal country. And but yeah, we took the donkey cart out there, and, you know, we got stopped by the cops, actually. So I'm sitting there like, you know, this is about to be really bad. So I never even told my wife that. But so anyway, yeah, so we're at Pinar del Rio. That's where LeVon's cousin lived. So he actually saved his money, which, I mean, I think they get, like, you know, everybody gets, like, the same amount, like the doctor and the chef or, like, the waiter, whatever. They all get like the same money, right? I think it's $30 a month. So he saved all of his money. Their entire home, smaller than this room right here. Four people living in there. Probably, I would say, about the size of these tables combined.
Wow.
Anyway, so his cousin saved his money for like a whole year just so he could come train with the national team. He came out there, only had money to get there. So LeVon was sharing his meals with him, and so now he's only eating two meals a day instead of the three or four, or maybe three meals instead of the four, something like that. But yeah, very, very fascinating. Just watching that, you know, you would just forget what we have and how blessed our lives are. And
humbling.
Humbling, man. I mean, these guys are just savages, man. Just hard workers and getting the job done, just getting nothing for it. You know, some of the guys at the top, like Mihan Lopez, he gets some things. Like Fundora, for instance, he got internet access. Like, whoa. That was like a blessing for him to have internet access because he had done so much for the country in the Olympics.
That's crazy.
I think he was a bronze medalist, I think.
They hooked him up with the internet.
He got hooked up with the internet. And I still email him every now and then. Like, he'll send me pictures of his family and stuff. And,
wow.
And you can, and it said, it's something like, you know, Fundora at CubaGovernment.net or something like that. You know what I mean? It's like a, so he goes through the government. So the government tracks every email coming in and out. So, yeah.
Wow.
So he would even tell me, like, before I left, you know, like don't email me this or this. Like,
right,
don't
right.
talk about this. And
wow.
Yeah, I think it's maybe laxed up a little bit, but I'm not sure.
Man.
So, yeah. I could tell you a lot of stories about it. It was really a very eye-opening experience. Like, I want to take my kids there sometime, like, just to see, like, look, You want to fucking, what if you grew up here, motherfucker?
Yeah, you know? No shit, right?
You know, be happy. You know, you got what you got. And
yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's because, so one of the pictures I could show you would be the wrestling room in Peñar del Rio. I think Yoel Romero came from there, actually. Mahan came from there. Levon came from there. And their wrestling room is actually probably about as big as this room. And it's a dirt floor. With the mats are, you know, so if you imagine a mat getting dissolved in water and like all the little pieces just spread out, so they sweep up all those pieces, put them in a it's about as big as this table here. They sweep it all together and stack it up, and that's their mat. So they just practice, you know, basically take down stuff, and that's why they're so hard to take down. They learn from a young age. Like, you get taken down, it fucking sucks.
Wow.
Yeah, I can show you a picture of it. I mean, it's really fascinating.
Wow. How long were you over there for?
6 to 8 weeks. I can't remember.
Something like that. That's a long time.
Yeah, we stayed for a long time. And we did basically the whole training camp over there.
For which fight?
Jordan Mean.
Wow.
And that was, so that was when I first started working with that guy. And you know, the first thing he said was like, you need better wrestling. Let's go to Cuba.
Holy shit.
I said, all right, let's go.
Wow.
And so I wrestled with those guys every day. My wrestling came up tremendously.
Oh, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way, sink or swim. And then like I said, I got to work with the boxing team. And the boxing team, I mean, the wrestling is one thing, but I seen a lot of the junior boxing team guys. I seen one kid get kicked off the boxing team. Like, they take their boxing very, very serious over there, right? That's their national sport. One kid got kicked off the team because he wasn't keeping up, and they were doing... They had to get up at like 5 a.m. do like an 8 mile run or something, and they put, you know, water bottles like this, and they fill it up with sand, and that's their dumbbells. And the kid didn't have any shoes, but he couldn't keep up, and they were doing hill sprints, and he kept falling behind. They're like, "You're off the team."
Whoa!
So they would do like a 5 a.m. and then they go to school, and then they do an afternoon workout, and then they go back to school, and then they do an evening workout, and they live in these dorms, and that's literally all they do. That's their entire life.
Wow. And
they want to get out, they, you know, or live a better life, you know, they be a champion or die.
Holy shit.
Yeah. And again, you know, I was looking all this or learning all this through translation. So, you know, I could have some things not exactly right. But, you know, I was living there with them for a little while.
Have you wanted to go to Thailand?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I do too.
Yeah, you know, my thing is, so like when I did that, my kids were very young, and it wasn't so bad to leave them with their mom for a little while. Now I have, you know, now I have three kids, specifically my daughter. It's just hard to leave.
Right.
And to fly to Thailand. Have you never been there?
No.
No, so yeah, to fly there, you know, is expensive, and, you know, I don't want to leave. I just can't leave my family anymore.
But there's places you can go and bring them. Like Phuket's supposed to be nice, right? Mm-hmm.
And it's, yeah, and again, the flights, you know, is what's expensive. Once you get there, it's cheap, right? But the flight, I mean, $1,000 per person, you know, I'm looking at $5,000 just to fly there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I want to, but that's the nice thing about having Doran.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. Yeah. Now, are you living in Colorado still, or are you here?
Yeah, so I live in Colorado right now, and then I'm coming back and forth a lot, coming to L.A. Here? Yeah, doing a lot of work with the Muscle Farm.
Because Muscle Farm's opening up their main headquarters now in Burbank. Is that what it's going to be?
Yep, so they moved here.
Why did you decide to move here?
Well, the CEO lives here, for one thing, and I think they're going to attract a lot more athletes here, and I think that they're going to be able to do a much bigger thing. And really what they're doing is they're restructuring the entire business. They're kind of moving away from just simply being, you know, well, they're changing like from Muscle Farm to MP, for instance. So it's not just for the bodybuilder type crowd and the, excuse me, for the meatheads and the, you know, and without, you know, I mean, they'll certainly still be catering to that crowd, but now they want to open it up more as a lifestyle brand, expand it, and they'll be doing a lot more stuff with a lot more athletes, which I think they'll be able to do out here better than in Denver.
But now, as a guy who's trained at sea level and you lived at Denver, how much of a benefit is it to be at that 5,500 feet
altitude? Pros and cons.
What's the con?
Well, the number one con is that you can't, your max capacity is lower.
So you can't work as hard.
You can't work as hard.
Right. But now, you get adapted, though?
You know, I've been a little torn with that because I tell you, when I do my max capacity training, I don't think I've been able to reach the same levels that I was at sea level. I've heard other people say that they are able to. My PRs, you know, in terms of lifts, have been comparable. But of course, I was at Westside before, so it's not
right.
You know, I mean, you're just not. I tell you what, you walk into Westside, like you hit a PR. Right. Period. Like you don't. It doesn't matter. It's just a. There's an energy in the air. There's an aura.
It's an intense place.
Yeah, you've been there.
Yeah.
I mean, you probably hit a PR, I bet, if you work out. again, there's pros and cons. I mean, the obvious pro is red blood cell count, and I think your lung capacity goes up.
But, yeah. The idea, they say, is to sleep at altitude, but to train at
exactly.
sea level.
Exactly, and it's so that you can push your max capacity at sea level and then recover.
Yeah, so if, like, if you're in California, you would live in Big Bear, but then you would train down in like San Bernardino or something like that.
Exactly, yeah. And I don't know. I don't even know California well enough to know that how that works.
Well, but Big Bear is pretty close. You get to Big Bear in 2 hours. Yeah, you could drive there
It's funny that people out here say that's close. like to me, 2 hours is a long-ass way.
Well, yeah, no, it's close as fuck here. 2 hours would take you that long to get to Irvine in traffic.
That's what everybody says.
If I got to work in Irvine, like if I'm doing the improv and it's an 8 o'clock show, I leave here at 4. I'm not bullshitting. I leave here at 4 p.m. and I'm stuck in traffic for 2.5 fucking hours. No bullshit.
So everybody here listens to podcasts, huh?
Yeah. Podcasts, audio books, you know, anything. Mm-hmm. Anything. Just keep your mind off that fucking, those red lights in front of you.
Right. Brake lights. I'm from Columbus, Ohio. Like, you can go around the outer belt in like an hour.
Yeah. Yeah. You guys have terrible traffic. It's like, stuck in traffic for 10 minutes.
Yeah. That's exactly it. Yeah.
Well,
yeah. I mean, Denver's pretty bad now, actually.
All that weed.
Yeah, all the weed, man. People just, everybody just went there. Yeah.
Last time I was there, I was like, what the fuck is going on here with all this traffic? It's just weed.
Apparently, I guess it's actually been growing for years like that anyway. But, man, when you go skiing, that's the worst, man. You come back from the ski resort, Sunday, 4 or 5 o'clock, dude. It's like, I just did it the other week, and it took me 3.5 hours for a 1.5 hour drive.
That's crazy. Yeah. Well, Denver's just... It's an amazing city because you're in this cool city that's a real city, a legit city, and then right outside is the fucking Rocky Mountains. It's right there.
Right there.
You drive an hour, and you're in the Rocky Mountains. Yep. I mean, fucking wilderness, Jack. Elk screaming and bears running around. You're like, wow. What other city has that? An hour outside the city, you're in the fucking mountains.
And it's sunny, too.
Yeah.
You get all four seasons, which I like.
And the people are cool as fuck.
Yeah, people are cool, yeah.
This is one of the few places I would live outside of California.
Well, you used to live there, right?
Yeah, I lived in Boulder.
Yeah. I'm not sure I would go to Boulder, but...
Well, I was in the mountains above Boulder.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was like 3,000 feet above Boulder. I was 8,500 feet. It was pretty interesting.
Nice. Did you feel a difference?
Yeah, man. Going up the stairs, you get tired. It's crazy. It's
Did you adapt to it and felt a difference from
No, I was only there for 3 months. My wife got pregnant. Yeah. My wife got pregnant, and it's rough up there for women if they haven't adapted. It's rough in Denver, but then you go 3,000 feet above Denver, it's real rough.
Yeah, I go up there all the time.
Yeah, if you're a woman and you get pregnant up there, it's like having the flu. Mm. It's real bad. And they have a really high instance of low birth weight and premature birth.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Denver does as well. Denver has one of the highest rates in the country of premature births.
I did not know that. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was up at my friend's house out by Edwards, a little bit past Vail the other day, and like you were talking about the elk and the bears and stuff.
Woo.
I mean, at nighttime, he said usually you shine a flashlight out and you see the eyes of the mountain lions.
Yes.
He's got dogs and stuff, and they're just sitting there waiting. He's got a fence now, but he's like, you just see their eyes.
There was a story that I tweeted out today in California where some fucking mountain lion was banging on this screen door or this glass door trying to get at this dog in California. Yeah, they got pictures of this cat.
You don't want to mess with those guys.
Fuck, man. Yeah, one of them ate my dog.
A bear is one thing. Oh, really?
Yeah, one of them ate my dog in Gold Hill. This fucking mountain lion, man. Right outside these people's house, trying to get at their little dog. Yeah, they took pictures of it. That, and it's killed a bunch of pets in the neighborhood, apparently. They have a real problem with them in California because they don't hunt them, so they're not scared of people at all. And
that's the problem with California, right? They're against everything that I'm for.
they're against
except
quite
for
a few
legalizing
things.
Weed.
It's ignorance based. They have an idea of what a mountain lion is, and that these are these majestic creatures and they shouldn't be hunted. And what they would like to do is eliminate all hunting and let nature sort it out on their own.
Yeah.
But yet they have grocery stores everywhere where they have food that's murdered animals that are factory farmed. It's the stupidest fucking shit ever. You're not going to turn the whole state into vegetarians. So this idea that you're going to eliminate hunting is so fucking stupid. It's like you would rather people...
They're trying to do that? Trying to eliminate hunting? Or
the people that are the most radical wildlife activists would like to eventually eliminate hunting and have all these animals sorted out with themselves in a natural way. But they're never going to eliminate people eating meat. 97% of the people in this country eat meat. That's a real number. Mm. So this idea that you're going to somehow or another change those 97% based on the desires of the 3%, which fluctuate back and forth, by the way. The 3%, there's a lot of those 3% that fall off, and they eventually, for health reasons, go back to eating meat again or eating some animal products.
These fish, huh?
Animals are fucking awesome. I love the fact they're real. I love that they're out there. But if you think that it's okay to have tons of mountain lions, I have a buddy who works at Tejon Ranch. They got a trail camera over there over a pond. They got photos of 16 different mountain lions visiting this pond. Yeah. What? Fuck, man.
That's intense.
And this is all because in the 1990s, they outlawed hunting of them. It doesn't make – they didn't do it for any rational reason.
A mountain lion is an apex predator, right?
It's an apex predator, and that you can eat them, and they're delicious. They taste like pork. Yeah. Yeah, my friend Steve shot one recently. He said it was one of the most delicious meals he's ever had in his life.
I'll have to try it.
Yeah, they have delicious fat that you cook them. And you cook it just like pork.
I never would have thought that.
I never would have thought
they're in the cat family, right?
Yeah, it's weird eating a cat.
Yeah.
But apparently they're delicious.
Probably have before.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. Unknowingly.
But just to control the population, to keep them from.
Yeah.
It's a good luck finding a deer in California. There's so
you
few
ever feel
deer
like,
out
like
here.
When you walk into the grocery store and you see the meat aisle? Like, do you just see animals sitting there? You know what I mean? Because you see, I mean, the meat aisle is gigantic, as big as this wall.
Yeah.
And like, when I see it, I just see a bunch of animals.
I'm yeah.
Like, man, like, none of these were treated right, raised right, killed right. And now they're packaged like there's some glorious, amazing food.
Well, it's just it's too sanitized and sterilized.
Yeah.
It's weird. And especially as someone who's killed animals and quartered them up in the field and carried them away and cut them up and put them and wrapped them and vacuum sealed them and put them in my freezer and then thawed them out and ate them. Like, I've been there through the whole process, so I look at the whole thing totally different now. When I go to the butcher section, it's just...
I did that when I was like 10 years old. So.
Yeah, so you've been doing it forever.
Yeah, well, I haven't hunted since I was like a teenager, but...
But you have, and you know it. So
yeah.
I just think,
I mean, we used to raise chickens, and like, my dad would be like, go kill a chicken for dinner. Like, that was like my job sometimes. So, yeah, same thing. You know, especially when, you know, like, you raise the animal, too.
Right.
Like, you become kind of, you know, have some compassion for it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you realize that chickens, in particular, I mean, way more so with cattle and pigs. Like, you realize pigs are very smart. You know, they're intelligent and
like a dog.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I feel like... I know that technically they're that smart, right? But there's something different about dogs, right?
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
For whatever reason.
Yeah, there's something different about it. Maybe just my bias from what I've been taught from society or whatever.
Yeah,
but,
culturally, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we have animals that we like better.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Certainly, yeah. I mean, I felt terrible, like, killing some of the pigs.
Yeah, I'd imagine.
Know? Yeah, and then you eat them, and... You know, personally, I mean, I always thought the grocery store sausage and bacon tasted way better. But I was like, man, that was sort of my excuse. I was like, man, it doesn't taste good. I'm not sure if I want to eat it. But in my head, I'm thinking, like, man, I really feel bad for this guy. I don't want to eat him. You know?
Yeah. No, I know what you mean, man. We have a weird disconnect with food in this country in particular, and especially in this day and age.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a majority of the people eating meat, and the majority of people never seen an animal die and then get chopped up and turned into meat and then eat it, there's always going to be this weird disconnect, and that's
how
what
you change that
with,
though.
Boy, I don't know. I don't know if you can. I just think it's one of the weird I think this society is an amazing thing. What we've accomplished, where you don't have to ever worry about food. You can just go down the store right down the street here and get a steak and cook it, and instantaneously. You don't have to kill it. You don't have to dress it. You don't have to. All these steps have been avoided. You just give them a piece of paper. That piece of paper gets you a steak. It's amazing. You know, you could go to a store down the corner over here and you can get gasoline. Some motherfucker had to go to the Middle East, pull oil out of the ground, refine it, put it in tanker trucks, drive it across the country, pump it into a hole in the ground. You swipe a piece of plastic through this reader. You punch in your area code or your zip code, whatever the fuck it is. What is it? Your zip code, right?
Zip code.
You put the nozzle in your tank. You fill your tank up with gas, this fucking car that's designed by engineers in a way you would never be able to figure out on your own. And you get to turn the key and drive this thing around. There's so many steps that have been taken to make our lives way more convenient.
You don't even have to do all that anymore. You have this thing in your hand. You just push a button and some dude's going to show up at your fucking door with food.
Yeah. Or some dude with a car and drives you anywhere you want to go.
Yeah, drive you where you go.
Yeah.
He shows up with the animal that's been slaughtered.
And cooked and
sterilized. And you ain't got to worry about if it's healthy or not.
No.
Like when I was in Cuba, they had, like I said, the red meat is, I don't know if it's illegal or just very hard to come by or whatever. But so we went to this sort of black market stand. And, man, I got a picture of it. I mean, it's a table bigger than this table of just red meat sitting out. There's flies on it. But people are just like, dude, yes, I want some.
Wow. I mean,
and it's all the different cuts and everything. Cut up just terribly.
Right. Wow. Yeah, we're lucky as shit, man. And this is the easiest time ever to be alive.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah, at least in America.
Yeah, in America. Yeah,
maybe not in some places.
No, I think that's why it's good to visit other places, man, just to get a look around and see what it's like.
That's one of my reasons I want to go to Thailand. Like, I want to go there and train, but only so much. I mean, I think that so much of the Thai skill training is already in America that it's not going to – you might get some details or whatever over there, but – They're also so traditional and so far behind us in terms of, at least in strength and conditioning and proper ways of training and things like that,
right.
That I don't know how beneficial that is. But I want to go over there and see how they live. I mean, they eat spiders and, these insects, and most people are ultra poor over there. And, they're really Buddhist, right? And I guess they kind of... they drop their kids off at the freaking Thai camp and just leave. It's very strange to us.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I find it fascinating.
Yeah, I do too. I find it incredibly fascinating. I talked to John Wayne Parr quite a bit about his experiences over there. Mm-hmm. He went over there when he was real young and lived over there and lived in Thai camps, lived like a Thai.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible stories, Mm. So it's just a very unique culture. It helps you appreciate where you live and puts things into perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there in, Japan? You've been there, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, I've been to Japan. Yeah. Fascinating.
Fascinated the shit out of me, too.
Like being in a foreign land that's also like on another planet.
People standing in line at the subway to get on the subway train.
Yeah.
No, I was there we did like a military tour, and I think Todd Duffy was there, and was it C.B. Dalloway, maybe? But yeah. You could see Todd over top of the crowd from like a mile away.
Right, yeah.
It's hilarious.
Yeah, it's interesting how polite they are over there.
So polite, yeah.
Yeah, it's like there's so much order and discipline. It's just completely fascinating.
Yeah, I remember him on the subway train. They're standing in line.
Yeah.
I just wanted to walk to the front of the line. Fuck you guys.
You probably could have done it. They probably wouldn't have even said anything.
Or then we did another one in Iraq. Or Middle East. Iraq was one of the places. Or did we? I can't remember. But the Middle East. And man, those people will shove you right out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, you funneling in through the airport or something.
Right.
And they're the rudest people ever when it comes to, standing in line.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, you say something to them, I don't speak English or whatever. I'm like, I don't speak your language either, so I guess we're fucked.
How many different countries have you fought in?
Only two. Yeah, I fought in the UK.
Is it a big transition going over there? Like the weight cut's got to be harder, and finding the right food.
When I fought over there, the weight cut wasn't that bad.
No. You said
finding the right food was terrible.
You said you've been on a ketogenic diet. We were talking before the podcast for the last 3 years.
About 3 years. Yeah, it was after I fought Johnny Hendricks actually. And I suffered a concussion, and that was what originally got me on to the idea of doing a ketogenic diet. And then I fought Robbie Lawler next, And
why did the concussion get you on the idea of having a
ketogenic diet? Well, it's good for TBI and concussion. I mean, that's the theory, at least. I don't think they have a lot of proof. I know they've done some research on mice, but not necessarily on humans. But they
believe it does. And how did you feel when you changed your diet?
In what sense?
Like, initially, was there a struggle?
Oh, yeah. The first couple of weeks is terrible.
That keto flu thing?
Yeah, yeah. I had it really bad. But I didn't do it after the Hendricks fight, but I started reading about it then. And then when I fought Lawler, I missed weight. I think it was like half a pound or something. And that was the only time I've ever missed weight in my life. I did everything exactly like I had done 100 times before. Me and my coach, Tom Berry, at Westside Barbell, we had everything planned out. We had a notebook of, you know, this is what we eat this day, this day, this day, and this day, and this moment. And everything's planned out. We did everything exactly the same. Ended up, you know, still missing weight. And that was when I realized my metabolism had changed. So I started looking more and more into different types of diets. So I've always been my own guinea pig. That's sort of a blessing and a curse for my that's why, you know, I want to be a coach, because I think I'll make a 10 times better coach than I was a fighter, because I've experimented on myself. That's why I have all these books and everything. And the problem with that, right, is that, you know, you get a bad info too, or you misinterpret, misunderstand it, and maybe it's for regular people and I'm a high level athlete, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, I used it, for one, for the concussion, and two, to sort of a metabolic shift into more fats. And I haven't missed weight since. So,
did you feel any benefit of switching to a ketogenic diet in terms of performance?
You know, I actually felt a lack of benefit, actually. So some of the max capacity lowered immediately. Some of my PRs went down over time.
Did they
time.
Come back up?
Yeah, they came back up. Yeah. So
how long? When did it go down? Like how long?
Right
after?
Away. Like right away. Within the first week or two. I mean,
right.
They're completely
takes
shot.
A few months to really truly adapt. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and then what I've done now over time is I've adapted the diet to, you know, I do a lot of different things now. So I'm not as ketogenic as I once was, where it was all keto, keto, keto. Now I don't even pay attention to my ketones. Well, I take that ketone ester like we took earlier. Mm-hmm. I take that a lot, which I fucking love. You probably feel it right now.
Yeah.
Like shit's amazing.
It tastes like sucking on Godzilla's dick. It does. It's like,
worse.
Yeah, maybe. It's like, whoa.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Whoa.
Terrible. But I use that, and then I use the you know, regular keto salt supplements.
Mm-hmm.
But that one, you know, for performance, actually brings my performance up higher than I would usually go.
Do you take that ketone ester before you train?
Yeah.
How long before you train?
So I take it with some glucose, usually about 20 minutes before I train.
And use those glucose packets?
Yeah.
Who makes those packets?
Just whatever, at the grocery store, Power Bar or whatever.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter.
It's just a matter of sugar.
Yeah, you just have to make sure you have some sugar because of the hypoglycemic effects. It'll drop your blood sugar
really
bad.
Because it's so potent.
It's very, very potent. Like, our ketones are probably in the 3. Like, I actually have my blood meter, maybe we'll check, but I'm probably in the 3 to 5 millimole range right now.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so, you know, I do that, and then, but now I've adjusted it where I'm not as concerned with staying in ketosis, because the main concern with that is I want to get the benefits for the brain and, you know, the TBI and things like that. Now it's, when I get closer to a fight, it's more about performance, right? So I'll add in some, I use like a Yucan starch. I use, like sweet potatoes, you know, certain starches that don't really affect your ketone levels,
right,
quite as much. So that can bring my performance up a lot better.
Well, I think there's a real issue with high-level athletes with the amount of work output that you put in, that you probably need more carbohydrates than the regular person that's on a ketogenic diet.
I've been again, I'm my own guinea pig, right? And I experiment with that. And I've been kind of torn with that, right? So one of the things that a lot of people kind of promulgate is that our sport is very anaerobic, and it's really not. It's a lot more aerobic, and your aerobic capacity will go up on keto. Your aerobic, my ability to recover specifically, without, even with no carbs, my blood glucose could be in 70s and 80s and not have carbs for weeks at a time, and my ability to recover goes up tremendously. Like we were talking about tendonitis, my tendonitis goes away. My injuries, my joints just feel better. I feel better all the way around. My brain feels better. And a lot of things like that, but when you do need to kick in that max capacity anaerobic part of things, that's where, you know, things
suffer a little bit.
Yeah, and that's where you have to add in the carbs And but again, you know, the amount of training that I do, I mean, I can add in a lot of carbs and I can still get away with it and stay, right. And I can even stay in ketosis if I want to. But I think a lot of people make the mistake that I made originally, again, as my own guinea pig, and I really focused on the blood ketone levels rather than the performance.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to be able to perform with high ketogenic levels, or, you know, high ketone levels in my blood. And it's not really necessary, right? Like, it should be solely performance-based,
right, you know?
But yeah. it did help me cut weight, though.
I thought it was fascinating what Ben Greenfeld was saying. We were talking about it before the podcast, about how he would carb up and then take ketone supplements. So he had the benefit of having a lot of carbohydrates in his system, but also having a lot of ketones in his system. Mm-hmm. And he said he felt like a fucking animal.
Yeah, and that's pretty similar. It's probably how we feel right now.
I mean, that's totally legal.
Yeah. Totally, yeah.
I mean, that's not.
And I tell you, like, when I take it, it does amazing things for me. I've heard stories of people when they take this ester that they'll pull out moves like they haven't done in 10 years. Like, they recalls these moves. I've done things where when I do it, I feel like I'm 5-6 years younger. I mean, it's done some fascinating things.
Just taking that drink,
just
that we
taking
drink.
The ester with some. Digging out of the trash,
pulling it out here.
Yeah, ketone aid.
Yeah, ketone aid, ketone ester.
Yeah, and
looks like you're a scientist, like this Breaking Bad type shit.
The thing with it, it's extremely expensive, and they're working on getting the. It's like burnt rubber.
Yeah,
they're working on getting the cost down. I think it's thinking.
How much are these things?
I'm not sure, but I think it's like $30 a gram. And that's like 40 grams, I think. Dave.
That's incredible.
I could be off on that. I'm not sure. But
that's quite pricey.
I heard that the UK cycling team used it. They paid like $6,000 for, you know, however much, just a small amount. And they used it for when they won the Tour de France, actually.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what I heard. Shit. I don't know how true it is, but I believe it. I mean, this shit does amazing things for you. But, yeah. So the keto, I mean, again, it can be used, if used properly, I think it can do a lot of benefits. I would recommend to all combat athletes, NFL players over, you know, that have taken concussions, taken hits to the brain, or that are over a certain age where your metabolism changes. I mean, that's where my biggest benefit was. And even TJ was talking about it, TJ Dillashaw, I was talking with him about it. His coach had him switch over because he was burning primarily carbohydrates.
Especially now, TJ is going to try to make 125.
Yeah, and I don't know if he was talking to me about long before that was ever talked about. So,
mm-hmm.
But you know, he did some tests on him and found that he's burning all carbohydrate all the time, which can be an issue in long training sessions specifically.
So he switched it up a bit.
Yeah, and I don't think he's going full keto, but I think he's doing something similar to like what I'm doing, where he's doing keto with some carbohydrates still, and he's using so basically, like, the only carbohydrates that we need as an athlete is for the workout, right? We don't need them after that, maybe for recovery, which is, again, I think it's debatable, but carbohydrate is not a necessary substance to even live. You know, you could live your entire life without eating a carbohydrate and be perfectly fine. So.
Yeah, there's a lot of guys that are doing this carnivore diet now.
I've heard of this.
Yeah. Mark Bell told me he's never felt better. He's doing that shit now. Yeah. Yeah, he's eating nothing but steak. Just eats steak all day.
Sausage or bacon?
Well, he eats bacon too, but it's mostly meat. Hmm. He's eating mostly meat.
Mostly meat? So what, no vegetables?
A little bit every now and then, but most of what he's eating is just meat.
See, I feel completely different when I load up my vegetables. Even a day or two. I mean, I don't know. Do you feel this?
I feel better.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan
everything.
Of everything. I love drinking it too. You know, I love getting like real rich green leafy vegetable juice.
Mm-hmm.
And I drink a lot of kale shakes where I'll take a goddamn bushel of kale that you're never going to sit down and eat. You're never going to eat that much kale. I'll blend that motherfucker up with a giant chunk of ginger and garlic. I'll throw an apple in there and a bunch of coconut oil. And I'll fucking throw some celery in there, and I'll drink it, and it's
Woo. I think I've seen that on YouTube. You put like a pear in there too, right?
Yeah, maybe a pear, maybe an apple. I'll mix it up. Sometimes I put peaches or pineapple in there too.
You put the whole thing in with the seeds and everything, or cut it up?
Fucking throw that bitch in there, so you don't grind it up, and just it's all performance. It doesn't taste good. Tastes like shit. You know, it's like I've had people try to drink it, and they're like, "Oh, I can't."
Dude, I gotta try this.
But dude, I drink it, and I feel like a fucking gorilla.
How much garlic you put in?
A lot, like 4 or 5 cloves. It's rough.
I just eat cloves now.
Yeah, I do that too. Yeah. I eat a lot of cloves. Yeah, where it burns when it's going down. Yeah. Like, yikes!
But you could feel it, right? Like within like an hour or two, you're like, damn, there's something in there, man.
Especially if I'm feeling anything, like I'm feeling a little sick, I'm feeling a little funky, like I'm kind of feeling a little worn down, maybe it's going around, I'll just chomp on some garlic.
You ever tried chaga root?
No.
I do this. I did it. Well, I've only actually done it one time when I was sick. My whole family got sick. Kids, you've been there, right?
Yeah.
Kids are miserable. All of us are laying down, like we're laying around, like we're in the hospital. You know, every couple seconds you hear a cough, and we're just laying there miserable. And I was the only one that did the chaga root. I put it in a crock pot, put you know, like 10 little chunks in there, and I was the only one that didn't get sick or didn't stay sick very long. I stayed sick for like a day or two, maybe.
Chaga root. Yeah. And what's supposed to be the benefit of this stuff?
Ah, man, I don't want to butcher this. Google it.
Google it. Yeah.
Yeah. I can't. I mean, it's an immune system enhancer. It's like I heard it from my friend who's a survivalist specialist expert.
Huh.
And he teaches these classes, you know, where you go out and live off of land and things like that, right? And, you know, he gets it from like Maine or Canada, and it's like this fungus that grows on trees, and it's really, really hard. And they chop it off, and then you grind it up, put it in a tea or something. And,
huh.
Supposedly, you know, it's really good for your immune system.
Well, how does it make you feel?
I don't feel anything. I didn't feel any difference at all. I mean, I'm sitting there drinking it like it's some bullshit, but I'm drinking it anyway. You know, I'll try it. You know, my guy told me. So, you know, and that's obviously that's very anecdotal, and it was like one instance. And I just got sick a couple weeks ago, and I completely forgot about it. And I was sick for like 2 weeks, but.
You had a pretty significant back injury at one point, right?
A herniated disc, yeah.
Yeah. How did you fix that?
I guess it's never really fixed, right? I got a epidural steroid injection first because I wanted to make the fight. It's when I was supposed to fight Condit the first time. It's like 2 weeks out of the fight.
And what is the epidural steroid? Does it relax the area and loosen the inflammation?
It's a corticosteroid.
Right.
Yeah, so it gets rid of the inflammation. It took mine. We did it on a Friday. This was like 2 weeks out of the fight. So what had happened is about 4 weeks out of the fight is when I originally heard it. And, you know, I'm like, I'm going to fucking suck it up and do it. I think you said you herniated this, so you know what it feels like, right? And I'm going to suck this shit up and I'm going to get through it. And, you know, I couldn't do anything. I could barely even hit pads, right? Well, I eventually ended up, you know, going to so this is part of my problem with chiropractors, right? So I went to a chiropractor first, and he's like, oh, yeah, you know, crack it, and it's all good, you know, and all this kind of garbage. Anyway, I ended up seeing a pain specialist, and he knew what it was within 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I got the epidural steroid, and it didn't work right away, so I had to get a second one later. So, the second time, though.
Masks the issue, right? Does it mask the issue?
Yeah, I think it
reduces some of the inflammation, so some of the problems of it.
Yeah, so that's it. I mean, he told me that. He said, you know, look, we're going to get you to the fight. This is the best way to get you to the fight.
Right.
But it didn't work well enough the first time, so I ended up getting a second one, and it worked very well the second time. But then, of course, as you know, having a herniated disc, it just took years to correct it, you know. And, I mean, I work on it all the time now. If I don't keep on it, then I will feel the effect. I'll feel the issues,
right?
Yeah, especially in jiu-jitsu,
right?
That's the worst. I mean,
is it your lower back?
Yeah, it's L5, I think.
Did you use Louis Simmons reverse hyper? Mm-hmm. Did you use that machine? Did that help?
Of course, yeah, of course. I do tons of the reverse hyper all the time. I mean, I have a whole routine that I do pretty much after pretty much every workout,
just to strengthen your back.
Yep, for back and hips. A lot of my personal problem was my hip mobility, and so I do the hips, abs, obliques. My psoas gets real tight, so I have to lay on a fucking kettlebell
and do
that thing. And, my hip flexors, you know, I started working with this strength and conditioning coach now that, man, you know, he works wonders for me.
Now, and you have your own line of shit, and you sent us a bunch of stuff. You sent us some fucking cool hammers, and you got wheelbarrows and a bunch of different things. Mm-hmm. What was your thought process behind, what was the name of the company?
Immortal Combat Equipment, ICE.
And there's it on online, immortalcombatequipment.com?
Yeah, so I have my website, immortalcombatequipment.co. And then it's on Westside Barbell. We sell on there, distribute through them, and EliteFTS.com. And basically the way that whole started was...
There we go. Nice.
Yeah, the way that whole thing started was with the wheelbarrows. Louis had a wheelbarrow that we was using all the time. He's used for probably 20 years. And I was like, man, I could build. That thing's a piece of junk. It's been around here like 20 years. It's falling apart. And right. I said, you know, let me build one. And we built one. One person asked me to build one for him. I said, okay, cool. And then another person asked me to build one for him. And then I said, man, maybe I should just start making these. And I'd had the ideas for the so I talked to an engineer, and we just started manufacturing them. And, you know, just it's sort of like a side project thing for me, so something I want to get into post-fight career. You know, right. Like I said, so there's a few things I want to do. You know, for one, strength conditioning coaching, martial arts coaching, you know, do some stuff with Muscle Farm, and... You know, I want to, you know, be able to sell my equipment, right? The hammers I thought of for a long time. I know, like, you guys do the maces. You know, these are different than the maces. They're actually a sledgehammer.
Right.
I'm sure if you swing a sledgehammer, it just doesn't make sense that you go to Home Depot and you buy a shit-ass 16-pound, 20-pound sledgehammer. Ours start at 15 pounds. I'll probably make a 10-pound at some point, maybe an 8 or a 7 or something. And, you know, they're usually square. They're... you know, it doesn't make any sense, right? So we just made it specifically for swinging.
For training.
And,
a good fat handle.
Yeah, a good fat handle. And you see also it has a ball in the end in case it slips out, so it keeps it in your hand. And it never made sense to me that I would see a 200-pound man and a 125-pound woman both swinging the same sledgehammer.
Right.
Especially these 200-pound men that, you know, like me. Like, I swing the 30, 35-pound sledgehammer, which you got to try. It's just insanely hard, but you have to have the right technique and everything. But, you know, I swing that for my workout and it's different things depending on.
Are you going to expand your line? Because you got the sledgehammers and the wheelbarrow.
Sledgehammer, wheelbarrow, and the grip balls.
Now, the grip balls, would you put them on like a carabiner or something like that and do chin-ups with it?
Yeah, connect it to anything. Actually, if you see on that video, we connect them to the wheelbarrow and carry the wheelbarrow with them. Okay. I love doing that. Tons of things. I mean, there's just a tons of options. That one.
My kids thought they were little baby kettlebells. They were doing kettlebell swings and shit. It was pretty
nice,
funny.
Nice. Yeah. I have some badass ideas, man. We're going to build some really, really cool stuff. You know, I don't know. I guess I could just say I don't really care. I mean, you know, like you used a belt squat before, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on prototyping one right now. I have actually about 10 prototypes. I just haven't had the time, energy to focus. I kind of like almost don't want it to grow too fast because like I'm still fighting. Mm-hmm. It's something I want to work on after fighting. And but basically we're doing a belt squat that you can walk with. So it's just going to have wheels and you just walk around anywhere with it. And you could sort of, you know, even like, you know, clinch with someone or whatever, which I mean, you can do tons of things like that with the Westside belt squat they already have. And there is other belt squats that can do similar things, but
yeah, the Westside one, they were telling me you could hit pads with it.
For
you
sure.
Could have somebody on the platform.
Which I do.
Do that? Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that thing. Just the way it loads up your hips like that. And just, it seems.
And one of the things that I think you'd probably really like, we're going to build, and they have one at Westside. You may have seen it when you went there. The Force treadmill.
Yes.
That's just the one at Westside. I mean, it's just a basic treadmill. Like if you buy one off like Woodway or whatever, they're like $3,000, $4,000. I think even like $5,000 or $6,000. I'm gonna build one. And you can sell for like $500, $600. You know, like you just put it in your garage, whatever. Like you don't need to buy a $5,000 Woodway treadmill.
Right. Why did you decide to start out with hammers and wheelbarrows?
Well, the hammers I wanted for myself.
Is that something you use all the time?
Absolutely. It's probably my favorite exercise. I mean, of course, every exercise is a tool, right? And, you know, you don't use a socket wrench on a screw, right? So, you know, we have there's a million different exercises that we do for MMA. Everybody asks me, what do? Like, you name it, I probably do it, right? My favorite hammers are probably my favorite thing, though. If I just had to pick one thing and say, this is what you need to do. I mean, the dynamic strength it builds is insane. The explosiveness, the core strength, the shoulder strength, the grip strength.
When did you start doing this?
4 or 5 years ago.
Because I remember, you know, back in the day, George Foreman used to chop wood. Yeah, and I remember thinking, like, why are they chopping? Yeah, I was like, why are they chopping wood? Mm-hmm. Like,
wow. Marciano was legendary for doing it.
Yeah.
Or not legendary. I mean, he's legendary for other things.
Right.
He did a lot. So we actually built a 45 and a 50-pound hammer, too, which became a really good door stopper.
Too heavy?
Yeah. So we maxed out it. We stopped at 35. But if anybody ever would want one, we can still
get one of
them.
Those for Francis.
I know, right?
That's a great idea.
Yeah. I'd like to see him do it, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if you just think about the way it you know, the hammer swings and everything. I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can do it. There's a lot of different exercises you can do with them. I mean, they're just, I think they're the most amazing tool there is for MMA athletes.
I've never used one.
Really?
Yeah.
Even like a Home Depot sledgehammer or nothing?
Nope. No never shit. Swung them. No.
Dude, so, I mean, it'll build your endurance up right away. But one thing that I love about the endurance part of it is you'll sit there and swing it, and like your body's going to, like when your body gets so tired, as long as you have decent techniques, your body will get so tired, you can still keep going though. Like, cause it's a lot of momentum, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? But you can keep going with the momentum.
Right. Yeah.
So no matter how tired you are.
Now you sent me some, so I'll start doing it here. What size tire should I get? A tractor tire?
Yeah.
What do you get?
Yeah, just tractor tire. Yeah.
Where do you get one of those?
I know I just go to the, you could use a regular tire, whatever. Like I go to like the, you can get them for free. Usually they'll give them to you because they just burn them.
Oh, okay.
You know, so they, like have, to, or they have to like dispose of them. Like a
like
tire
a
shop.
Tire
yeah.
shop.
Yeah, junk tire shop. Yeah.
I'll go to a tire shop. Yeah. Give me a big ass tire, bitch.
Yeah. That's what I do. I mean, sometimes like they might give you like a regular tire also, mm-hmm. you know, and you just like bolt it together, you know, drill a hole and bolt two of them together and you got it.
Right.
You can do that way too. But
is that what you do? You put stack them?
That's what I've had to do that before where the tire shop didn't have a big tractor tire and I just get sick of looking for one. Sometimes right. they're hard to find. Like farmers will have them. I don't know about California. They could be completely different out here. So, you know, I mean, you can buy like off Rogue or whatever. They have things that you hit with the hammers, you know.
Oh, but, really? Rogue has things like, other than a tire?
Yeah, they have an actual. So, like, if you ever seen the CrossFit Games, like they do the game, I don't know, game, whatever it is, CrossFit competition thing. It's like a big piece of rubber, and they have to move it from like one side to the other, like 10 yards or something. Right. They have to hit it with the hammer.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
and so, okay. But their hammer, so it's like Rogue makes a hammer. Oh, there it is.
So it's like a big hunk of rubber.
Yeah, yeah. Those are great. And
oh, okay.
So like Rogue makes a hammer, right? That's adjustable weight too. Mm-hmm. But there's you unbolt it and pour BBs into it.
Oh,
I'm like, this is ridiculous, right? Like who's actually going to do that? And they have fucking BBs everywhere, all this kind of shit.
Right.
So that's why you know I was like. You know, I go to Westside. I have a fucking Dave Hoff is there, 300. You know, the strongest man in history. I'm like, if he's going to swing a hammer, it's not going to be a fucking 16-pound hammer. He'll do that with his, you know, one handed.
Right.
So you know, so I wanted to build something that anybody could use. And then the wheelbarrow, you know, we had to put where it can hold. I've had over 1,000 pounds on it at Westside.
Jesus.
You know, I can't lift 1,000 pounds on it, but. You know, put over 1,000 pounds on there. We have different handles. So that's what I changed. So Louis was just one handle, right? So we have D handles, right? So you can grip it like this, do like a clean press, things mm-hmm. like that. We have like a turn into like a prowler, you know, so it's got handles coming up, things like that.
And you just do laps with it? You just.
You do laps. I mean, like I say, you use like a prowler, you can do mm-hmm. cleans, overhead presses. I mean, there's a million different things you can do with it.
So when you're slamming. When you're doing a hammer workout and you're slamming a tire, mm-hmm. like where are you feeling it most? Your back? Your legs?
You know,
everywhere?
Yeah, usually not the legs so much. You know, that's more just you just kind of stabilizing with your legs. But a lot of times, it depends on your weakness too, right? Some mm-hmm. people feel it more in their shoulders. I usually feel it more in my grip.
Mm.
You know, because, but there's a few different ways you can do it too. So, like if I want to feel it more in my grip, I'll do a slam where I try to stop it.
Okay.
Right? So, you know,
at the very end.
At the very end, as soon as it hits, because the tire is going to bounce it back, right. and I'll try to stop it. But a lot of times I feel it more in the core, right? And then sometimes I do, like, you know, over the head, like this, boom, you know, right. and bring it down that way and feel it way more in the core.
Do you ever try to swing it sideways?
Yeah, I'm not quite as fond on that. I just, it gets a little dangerous. And
right.
I think you kind of, which I personally, I would do it, like, I wouldn't recommend other people do it unless they've been swinging hammers for a while.
Right.
I remember, I've just seen people do stupid things,
Now, what other kind of shit do you do for strength and conditioning?
You name it. That's what I was going to say, you know. I mean, we follow the West Side conjugate system, so it's really, you know, things change all the time. I mean, you know, it depends on if it's general, specific. So I always add in a third one. There's, you know, there's GPP, general physical preparation. There's SPP, which is specific physical preparation. And then I add in personally my own, which is RSPP, which is what I call like the hammers. Like the wheelbarrow would be more, I would call it the war wagon, is more general, right? So it's just going to build general strength. You know, it's going to bring your endurance up, your max capacity up, things like that. The, you know, getting on the mats and, you know, doing 20 double legs, that's SPP, like very specific, right? The something like a hammer or maybe a lot of band type stuff, like maybe shooting double legs with a band on or something, I call that RSPP, which is like replicated specific physical preparation. So, you know, I could break down all three of these and just go on forever. I mean, with when you're in the GPP, you're going to, again, like build up your max capacity. You're going to build up your strength. You want to build up your bone density, your ligament strength, your tendon strength. You have, of course, like any weaknesses, I'm big on the neck, back, and posterior chain, right? They say the front's for show, the back's for go. So we're
have you ever used the iron neck?
Oh, yeah. Yep, we use it all the time. Yep.
I love that fucking
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, I love that thing. Yeah.
Isn't that thing amazing? Yep, what a genius invention.
I know, right? I think it's really uncomfortable, but...
Yeah, I got one of those out here. Yeah,
nice.
I love it. Yeah,
nice. I like it. I don't like
it. I got one at home, too.
To be honest, I think clinching does more than anything else, man, mm-hmm. for neck strength. Like, my neck just gets more sore doing that than anything else.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's... using... My friends at Westside, they do a lot where they'll put a band on the war wagon and then carry it at the same time.
Oh, wow.
So it's pulling the neck while you're you have
that.
To walk. So it's like a very dynamic workout at the same time. So your grip's giving out, your traps start giving out.
What kind of harness are they putting on their head?
Just like, you know, the leather
like neck
boxer
type
thing. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And, you know, just with a chain and then a band. And so you're having to hold this while you're walking. Makes it much more dynamic. So,
ooh, I like that.
They come up with some crazy shit there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
that's
if you
I
go to
about.
The Iron Neck Instagram page, they do a lot of crazy shit with the Iron Neck on. Like a lot of medicine ball shit, a lot of slams while you're, you know, you're pulled back so you're on full resistance with the band. You're moving your head and you're rotating, slamming the ball to the right and the left. Things along those lines.
I'll have to check that out. I've never checked out their Instagram. But I try to stay off Instagram personally. But
why do you do that?
Man, for one, Instagram to me is the most mindless thing in the world, right?
Just looking at pictures,
it's just pictures
over and
man.
Over and over, and over and over and over and over and over. Yeah.
Yep. And half the time you don't even read breakdown,
captions.
The captions. Yeah. So to me, it's really social media is first off is pretty dumbed down. Like read a fucking book, right? And then now you have something that's not even. You know, you're not even writing. Like, it's just pictures. Like, you know, like the people that are like, oh, does the book have any pictures? Well, I'm not going to read it or something, you know? So to me, and I also, I'm a big believer that in what goes in your brain, in your mind, what you let in, it needs to be very controlled. You need to be very specific and careful about what you let in. Mm. And you never know what you're going to come across on there. So it could be something toxic that could be bad.
Right, so, especially if you're reading comments, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it gets way worse. Yeah. Which, and, you know, I use it. I mean, I'm on there a lot, but, you know, I use it. I like to. I remember back in the day when I was coming up, and, you know, I would dream of talking to a UFC fighter, right?
So
I use it to interact with my fans, right? Because I want to give some kids that experience.
Right.
I think
it's
a very powerful tool for that.
Oh, yeah. That's a powerful thing for a young guy coming up, you know, to be able to talk to Matt Brown and you actually respond to him and say good luck. You're like, holy shit.
Yeah. I mean, I probably do it maybe even more than I should. Like, I mean, I answer like complete questions sometimes. You know, like people ask me the wildest questions, you know, and I'll give them complete responses. But and I find that 90% of the time, they're like, oh, cool, man. Glad you responded. And then they forget about it, most likely, right?
Yeah.
And then, but, you know, if I can touch just a few people, man, I mean, that's really what the whole thing's about.
Do you have a YouTube channel?
No, but I probably will.
That's maybe a good move for you because you've got so much information in your head. Like, just talking to you before the podcast, you're rattling off these different training modalities and different recovery methods and techniques and shit like that. I was like, Matt Brown's got a lot of information in his head.
Yeah, I'm not dumb. I might be a savage, but I mean,
yeah. It's funny how people think those things are mutually exclusive.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, like if you're a savage, you got to be stupid.
Absolutely. And my thing is my savageness, I approach all things with that savage intent. Right? So when I, like, if I'm into a book, like I'm reading a badass book right now. And
what is it?
Anti-Fragile.
What is that?
I'm trying to remember the name of the author, but it's on my Kindle. And so if you think of there's no term, there's no definition of fragility or anti-fragile.
Right.
So he came up with this term. He wrote the book, The Black Swan, also. And
Nassim Nicholas Taleb. Yeah. Oh, I've heard of that guy.
He has a very interesting way of writing. And he really digs deep into this concept of anti-fragility, where it's not necessarily robustness or things like it. God, I hate trying to re-explain because I butcher shit. I feel like I don't give it justice, but you know, I'm only like halfway through the book, but like I said, I've really attacked it like with that savage sort of a mindset, right? But it's a very, very long book. Well, it's basically, you know, like our you know, he makes the case that fragility is you know, good, right? And it creates anti-fragility. He makes the case that anti-fragility is good, right? And not necessarily. Like I said, I feel like I'm just butchering it, man. Just read the book. It's a fucking good book.
But when he says about when you're saying fragility, do you mean fragility in terms of your mindset, in terms of just...
So he's an economic guy.
Uh-huh.
So he's really... I think what he's getting at, again, I'm only halfway through the book, but I think really what he's getting at is more economic and political is kind of his long-term thing. But he uses a lot of examples. And basically, from what I've gathered so far, it's basically like how stress induces a stress response, which induces strength, and which is the closest thing I would say is to anti-fragility is strength, right?
Right.
And how anti-fragility would make the world a better place, more or less. And
so as a response to stress, like training, basically.
Exactly, yeah. And I mean, he even uses that example, you know, how we tear our muscles down to build them up. That's the entire purpose, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's... again, I'm only halfway through, man. I don't want to butcher it, you know?
Yeah, no,
but
I know
it's a fucking
saying.
Great book. But like I said, I mean, it's a long, long, very long book, and it's sort of he kind of digs into all these different subjects on it, even though it's really like he could probably sum it up in about a quarter of the book. But, you know, I was just saying, you know, I just attack it like that, man. I just, you know... like, for instance, Super Training. You know this book, right?
I've heard of it. I haven't read it, though.
Well, it's probably the most difficult to read book I've ever read, and I've read it probably 4 or 5 times now.
What's so difficult about it?
It's just ultra, ultra scientific, and it's written by Mel Siff and Verkhoshansky, who is the inventor of plyometrics, or the founder of plyometrics in the Russians. And Mel Siff is a biomechanical engineer, and the two of them came together, and you know, this Super Training is basically like the Bible of strength and conditioning books altogether, right? It's the original strength and conditioning book. I mean, there's also like Science and Practice of Strength Training. There's Science of Sports Training. There's a lot of really good books, but Super Training is like the pioneer, the premier book, right? And it's all very, very scientific. And a lot of the times, man, I'll have to read a same paragraph like 4 times, you know, and I've read the book like 4 times and I'm going through the paragraph like, what the fuck, man? What is he talking about? This son of a bitch. So anyway, so like the point is like I just attack it like that,
right?
Man, you know, and I think there's other things. I think a lot of people, again, like it's all about inspiring others, right? And I think a lot of people could learn a lot from that. And that's what I try to do in my fights. I try to inspire people. I want my kids to be that way. I think it could bring the world up that way, man. People find something they want and attack it like a goddamn savage.
Well, when people see someone that does really go for it, it does inspire them to go for it too. They see the excitement in it, and they see the response that other people have to that excitement, and it just makes them want to up their own life performance in a lot of various ways, you know, not just in fighting, but they might want to up their performance from watching you fight in whatever the fuck they're doing in life.
Mm-hmm. And that's to me, that means more than anything else. That's what a lot of people talk about, the meaning of life. I think I got it figured out. I mean, I think the meaning of life is to give. I think that's, if you look in nature, I know you're a big nature buff. I mean, that's what everything exists in nature to do. That's what a tree grows fruit to give more fruit, right? That this is the natural process of the world. And humans, a human animal has become too analytical to figure that out, right? We think the meaning of life is all these other things because we think about other things, but really our entire purpose is to give.
I think there's a lot of purposes in life, but I think that is one of them for sure. I think giving is definitely, it gives you a sense of meaning, and when you help other people, you feel better. You know, that's one thing that I think people are missing out on. They think that it should be all about themselves, and I'm just about succeeding and getting by on my own.
Well, even what you just said, you know, gives you a sense of meaning,
yeah,
or makes you feel better.
Yeah.
So you brought it back to yourself, right?
Right.
And that's what I think it's human nature, and that's easy. But I try to get past that where where it's not about me. It's not about how I feel about it. It's about just giving. You know, completely selfless.
That's a great way to look at it. The way I describe it that way, though, is to enlighten people to this idea that I think not enlighten people, but just express my own perspective that I think people spend too much time thinking about what benefits them, and that they don't recognize that the more you benefit other people, that is really what benefits not just those other people, but you as well. And that they think of like helping people, like, yeah, it'd be good to help people, but that's going to fuck me up because then I'm going to spend less time on my own self. But it's not really the case. You actually enhance your own experience in life by helping other people.
As we were talking about before the podcast, right? The abundance mentality.
Yes.
And that is specifically the abundance mentality.
Yeah, no, I'm a gigantic believer in generosity, in abundance mentality, and I'm a fucking ferocious opponent of famine thinking. I think that famine mentality, it fucks people up so hard. You get closed up, you get, you know, ultra protective, you get ultra, I just think that's a terrible way to live your life, and you're living your life with fear.
And the hard part is implementing it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can see her talk about it all day. Like, I don't give enough to, you know what I mean? I don't give enough away, that's for sure. I've thought about sometimes, like, I think about crazy shit sometimes, and I was like, I think the ultimate, like coolest thing in life, so I have to have money, like, for my kids, unfortunately, right? Not unfortunate, but.
Right, just necessity.
Yeah, necessity. Yeah. Like, that's what the money is about. I feel like if I didn't have kids, I would just give literally every dime away, start from bottom and see how many times, because, you know, so there's like certain qualities in people that they're going to succeed no matter what, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I want to see like if I have those qualities, right? So I want to give everything away.
Well, I'll
start
fix that
from
right
scratch.
Now. You definitely do. Listen, man, you could do whatever the fuck you want in this life, but I feel like a guy like you in particular, especially right now when you're on this this fighting journey. And you're still on it. I think what you give the most is through the best possible performance that you give. And when you have these wild, crazy performances like the Diego Sanchez fight, that shit inspires the fuck out of people. I mean, how many people watched that fight and just wanted to go run mountains and just get crazy? It's just...
Man, that's cool you bring that up, because I mean, I never even thought of it that way. Like, I always see it... Again, I always bring it back to myself, and I see it as an expression of my own art.
You're a public performer.
Yeah.
You're not just an athlete, you're not just a fighter, but you're also a public performer and an inspirational figure. And when you are doing your best, that gives a lot to people. I mean, just how many people have watched great athletic performances and it's given them the fuel and the inspiration to do great things in their own life?
Man, that's cool you say that, yeah, because... Man, that might inspire me to fight a little longer, you know?
Well, you were ready to retire after the Diego fight. That was supposed to be your swan song.
Yep.
What was it, just too sweet?
No. It wasn't. It had nothing to do with the performance, actually. This, you know, so I think when we started the podcast, I was kind of talking about the why and the how a little bit, right? And this is where I think I got a little confused was I mean, for one, I was questioning a lot of things. I got knocked out by Cowboy viciously. The worst. I've never been knocked out in my life. I mean, and it wasn't too long after I just got dropped hard by Ellenberger, which was the first time in my life I'd ever been dropped in sparring or anything. I'd never been dropped. So I started just kind of questioning, you know, what am I doing? Okay, well, how? And the first thing I went to was, how do I not make that happen again? So that gets very exhausting when you just like, how, right?
Right.
And I think through the Diego camp, because, again, I announced the retirement long, you know, very early in the camp, like 12 weeks out or something like that. Through the camp, everything went so well. I focused more on my own mind and a lot of these things we're talking about, and I started getting back into the why, and I started bringing a lot more clarity to that side of things. Now I know why I'm doing what I'm doing. I feel much more comfortable, and now it doesn't matter on the performance anymore. Now it's about truly going out there and performing the best that I can. And then the second part of the whole thing is that you know, I was very scared of retirement. I was very, very nervous to be thinking, like, what am I going to do? You right. know, like, how am I going to feed my kids? And fortunately, now, you know, I was able to – I realized once I announced it and then after the fight, I mean, just a plethora of opportunities. And Muscle Farm's probably been my best opportunity, and that's why, you know, I bring them up a lot, you know, because they've helped me so much. And I think we're going to do amazing things there, whether I retire or not. And I think it's going to be a big, beautiful thing.
What do you do for them specifically?
I'm kind of tasked with building the fight team and bringing the athletes and communicating with athletes and, you know, just making it a solid program there. Whether I'm the coach or not, it doesn't even matter. But, you know, I want to make a great program and make sure that, you know, the facility is being used properly and bring in different athletes. And that'll be kind of the first step. And then beyond that, I mean, the opportunities are endless. I can do a lot of different things with it.
So what was the thought process that was it immediately after the Diego Sanchez fight? Because I talked to you in Denver. Mm-hmm. When you came to my show at the Belco, I called you up. We were talking and you said, I'm not really sure I'm done. And I was like, what's going on?
Well, that was, so I don't remember the exact date of that, but that was probably, you know, I said the retirement, and then again, like the camp just started going amazing. And again, the why came back, man. Like, right. I knew why I was doing what I was doing. Like, I was enjoying my time at the gym again.
Weren't you enjoying it?
There's been a lot of times. I mean,
what do you think?
You know, I've been around and I've had a lot of different coaches and, That's my biggest. If I had a regret in my career, is that I wasn't as loyal to one sort of system as I should have been. I have a term for it now. I call it the unicorn fallacy, where you're constantly chasing the unicorn that doesn't exist, right? Some people, I've heard other people call it like the greener grass syndrome. You know, the grass isn't always greener on their side, right? And that would, if I had a complaint about myself, or if you want to call it a regret, like that's my problem. Like I'm always like, dude, I just need to go over here and I'll get better, because I'm always searching that how, right? Mm-hmm. And I forgot the why. So, you know, so again, you know, I think a lot of fighters probably also go through this where, I mean, it's hard what we do. There's a lot of pressure on our shoulders. There's a lot of, especially with a family. I got three kids, you know, right. It's like, I mean, I got knocked out in front of my three kids. Like they were at the fight, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
Like I had I think they were, I don't even remember because I was fucking knocked out, you know,
right,
like,
right.
Like I don't remember anything until I was waking up at the hospital, you know, and Dwayne was sitting there, you know what I mean? So like, I mean, looking back, like I don't even remember all this stuff. And, it's funny because I've seen videos like, you know, them raising Cowboy's hand. Like, I don't even remember seeing that. Like, somebody told me that, you know, we were talking backstage. I seen a video, I should say, of us talking backstage. I don't remember none of that. Right. So, things like that, you know, it makes you start questioning, like, dude, it's like, is this shit worth it? You know?
Right, right.
I mean, you know, and just a lot of internal struggles, right? And again, you know, the camp I had with Diego. Man, everything, just all the pieces fell into place. And I was like, dude, if I can do this every time, like I could do this for a long time and I could smash a lot of people.
So that's where you're at right now.
Yeah.
So you were reinvigorated.
Reinvigorated.
That's interesting. So this long career, so many great fights, and you're still like finding
your
place.
To be honest, I think I'm fucking hungrier than I ever was.
Wow.
Man, I was like, because of like a lot of stuff we're talking about today, it just wasn't clear. You know what I mean? It was just a scatterbrain. Like, again, it was all about the how. You know, right. Like I think I was kind of hyper focused on that. Like, how do I get stronger? How do I get faster? How do I throw a better punch? How do I, you know, analyze this guy, and how do I beat him? And, you know, it's just constant how. And then you forget, like, why are you doing this anyway?
Right.
You know, so, and then, I mean, like I said, it's just a, it's not an easy sport anyway. I mean,
it's probably the hardest sport that's ever existed. I don't think there's anything harder.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what's harder other than actual war.
Yeah, right?
I mean, right, maybe right. Police officer, fireman, actual war, fucking trauma surgeon.
Even them, I mean, you know? I mean, it's harder in different ways, right?
Yeah, harder in different ways. Yeah, it's one of the most pressure-filled athletic opportunities that a person can ever be involved in.
Yeah.
And now, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, the hard thing is this is all I've done. I'm all in, you know, from the beginning. Like, I never gave myself an out. And I think that's important to do also. A lot of the guys that have outs, I mean, I watch Shark Tank all the time, and you see, you know, these guys, that if they have an out, then you know, Kevin O'Leary or whatever is like, like, you know, fuck you. I'm not
going like, to best you. Yeah, rich kids don't grow up to be world championship fighters.
Except for BJ Penn.
Yeah, right? He's just a fucking animal. But he grew up in Hawaii. Hawaii is a different place. Like, you're stuck on an island with a bunch of motherfuckers who want to kick your ass. Like, it's do or die in Hawaii.
Right, right.
Hawaii is an underappreciated place for tough motherfuckers, you know?
I'll have to go there. My wife wants to go
there. Never been?
Bad.
I went
there once. Yeah.
I'd live there.
I was in, like, Waikiki the whole time.
I'd live on the Big Island.
Yeah?
Fuck yeah. I could live there. Yeah.
You wouldn't get an island, what do they call it, island sick?
Or, nope. So. If I did, I'd get a plane. People are awesome there, man. It's just a different, more relaxed, more, I don't know, they're just more chill.
They say Costa Rica is the place to go.
Costa Rica's pretty badass.
They say it's the best place to retire.
Yeah?
That's what I've heard, because it's like $1,000 a month you can live well or something.
Yeah, Mel Gibson's got a fat spread there. He's telling me he's got like 500 acres down there.
Nice. That was a cool podcast with Mel Gibson.
He's an interesting cat, huh?
Yeah.
Here's my impression of Mel Gibson. He just kept clicking the fucking pen. He just kept clicking the pen, and I didn't want to say anything. I was like, what do I say? Stop clicking the pen, Mel.
I was interested. I wanted to hear, like, I kind of wanted to hear you interview him a little bit. It was like all the stem cell guy, huh?
Well, he wanted to come on and talk about stem cells. That's really what he wanted to talk about. Yeah. And so I honored that. I said, all right, man. All right. You know, that's what you want to talk about.
You think he's your biggest guest you've ever had?
He's pretty fucking famous.
Him or James Hetfield.
He's pretty fucking famous, too. I mean, I don't know. They're up there. Who else? Alex Jones? He's the biggest.
I love Alex Jones.
The most downloads. Alex beat everybody by
Did he
a
really?
Fuckload. Yeah, man. It was interesting.
So here's my theory on Alex Jones.
Uh-oh.
Just if you want to go there.
Okay.
I love going there. So I think he's a government plot.
He's not. I'll tell you that for sure. I've known him forever. I've known Alex since 1998. He's not a
but
government
he couldn't,
plot.
He couldn't tell you because you would tell everybody.
He's not. I've hung out with that guy. I get high with him. I'm drunk with him. He's a fun dude. He is a guy who started out as a guy who was against the president. He was against George W. Bush. W. Bush, I don't even think he was running for president at the time, right? Or was he? When did Bush become? No, Clinton was president. Yeah, Clinton was president. George W. was the governor of Texas. And he was getting arrested for protesting against them, protesting against the global elitists and all these different things.
Right.
He didn't really become a supporter of any form of government until Trump. I mean, Trump is like the first guy, and he may or may not be getting played by Trump, where, you know, Trump's his buddy. And I mean, Trump is he's a slick guy in terms of how he cultivates influence.
He's an anomaly for sure. Right?
So he's an interesting character in a lot of ways. I mean, if it wasn't
shoot down my theory completely. Let me. And it's just a theory. I'm not. Okay. I don't promulgate this fact or anything.
Okay.
But I've always thought that Alex Jones was built by the government to make conspiracy theorists look like loons.
He didn't used to make them look like loons.
Really?
No. He was much more.
I mean, it started with 9/11, though, right?
No. Alex was way before 9/11.
But I mean,
he started with Waco.
But that's when he came to prominence, right? Like, because he was the first to kind of.
No, even before then, man. You know, I mean,
but nobody cared about him before.
He was on AM radio before then,
right?
But he's been around forever. Right. I mean, like I said, I met him.
Well,
in
I'm
98.
Glad I'm wrong then.
I met him in '98, so it was several years before 2001. And he was doing the same shit back then.
Nice.
I mean, he's always been around doing that.
Right.
He's right about a lot of shit, and that's what's so confusing.
Right.
Like, he is absolutely right about what they call agent provocateurs, where the government will send in people. If they have a peaceful protest, it's very inconvenient for them, like the WTO. He did this whole video about how the WTO, was that in Vancouver or Seattle? Where was the WTO? I forget where it was. It was somewhere in the Pacific Northwest. I'm confused. But I'm not confused about the story. So what happened was they had these peaceful protests against the World Trade Organization. And it was very inconvenient because all these world leaders were coming to this area for this meeting. And they sent in government agents that were dressed with black ski masks and government issue boots. And these people started smashing windows and lighting things on fire. They turned into a violent protest, which enabled the police to close in and shut down the protest.
Shit.
Your WTO protest, where did it say? Alex Jones, police state
Seattle,
to
yeah.
the takeover. Seattle?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Seattle. Okay.
So
this is a real tactic that governments and intelligence agencies use. They have a peaceful protest, and then they have these people, like these guys, dressed in black ski masks. They start tipping over newspaper stands. Like, it doesn't even make any sense. Like,
so
why are they doing this?
So confirm that they're government agents.
Meanwhile, these guys have government-issue boots. No, it goes further. So these guys all got together at the end, and they were cordoned off into a building, and then they were ultimately released. They were never charged. They were never arrested.
No,
I mean,
shit.
The whole thing is incredibly fascinating. And some of them have been identified as government agents, and Alex can get way more into detail about it.
That's why, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, so to speak. But the one thing I always say is, I don't put anything past our government.
There's absolutely been conspiracies that are real.
For sure.
Absolutely.
For sure. Yeah.
Whether it's the Gulf of Tonkin incident, whether it's Operation Northwoods, I'm sure there's been a bunch that we don't know about. I believe that the government assassinated, or somebody assassinated JFK. I don't think it was Lee Harvey Oswald acting alone. I think it's very possible Lee Harvey Oswald was a part of it, but I know too much about bullets to think that that fucking bullet went through two people and wound up on Connolly's gurney in the hospital looking pristine.
Shit.
Cut the shit. That's all. I don't think that's real at all.
Nice.
I've seen the Zapruder film. I've read several books on the story. I think it's very convenient to lump all that into one guy with one bullet. I think it's horseshit. And I think they probably killed him.
All right.
Dum, dum, dum.
See, I always look into it a little bit, you know, and then I'm like, you know what? Like, the government probably did this shit, whatever.
They probably
like
did a lot of shit. They probably did a lot of shit that we don't know about, that we're not aware of.
Yeah.
But this is how governments work. They've always worked like that. This is how intelligence agencies work.
I say the smart criminals go to politics, the dumb criminals go to jail.
Yeah, you know? Right. There's a lot of that. Definitely a lot of that.
I mean, or you know, the most criminally insane people in this world are attracted to politics.
I think what's going to fix human beings, and this is a radical idea, but I really think the same thing that's going to fix human beings is what is, in a lot of ways, disrupting the standards of our culture right now with the internet. I think technology is going to fix human beings, because I think what technology is going to do is eventually there's going to be a way to absolutely detect whether or not someone's telling the truth. I think it's inevitable. I think as we find out,
fuck up a lot of people's lives.
It's going to fuck up a lot of people's lives, and it's going to enhance most of our lives. And I think people like you and people like me who tell the truth, it's going to be very good for you. Because I think when you lie, it doesn't just fuck up the person that you're lying to. I think it fucks you up. I think it fucks up discourse. It fucks up culture. I think it fucks up human beings. It fucks up our communities. It's just it's an anomaly. It's a thing that people have been able to figure out how to do, where you've been able to say things that aren't accurate to convince someone of a reality that doesn't exist.
I guess where I think it gets hard, though, is the politicians specifically are so good at not really lying, but like, you know, they're right on that gray area
mm-hmm.
where they're not really lying to you, but they're not
That's also because you can lie. So like a guy like Trump, right, who's been busted lying a million times and still is in office.
Which probably every president.
Yes, yeah, for sure.
I don't think he's
Obama's busted lying too.
I don't think he's unique in that. No. That's,
well, he's unique in his propensity for it. I mean, he loves it. He's a good, I mean, he's been lying forever. But I think that without a doubt, there's going to be a time in the future, whether it's in our lifetimes or after, where they develop technology that's going to absolutely allow you to detect whether or not someone's telling the truth.
That's intense.
Yeah, I think it's going to be the future. Yeah. And I think when that happens, people are just not going to accept all the shit that we've accepted for so many years.
Think it'd be an app on the phone?
I think it's probably going to be something that you wear in your body. I think we're real close to that. I think we're real close to embedded chips that you wear in your body. And I think those chips are probably going to interface wirelessly, and you're just going to be able to read thoughts and ideas that come from people that are going to come in probably a new language. I think we're going to be able to develop a universal language.
Like, don't a lot of religious people say it's the mark of the beast, right?
Oh, that's... Isn't that like a birthmark or some shit? Like, what do the religious people think? Like a chip inside your body's
so
a mark of the beast?
I was raised in an ultra religious environment, right? My mom was extremely religious. And
did they talk in tongues?
They probably thought they did or something. No, they, you know, they're very fundamental. You know, my brother could go way deeper into what they were about. I never even paid attention, but I remember them talking about, like the mark of the beast, and they're like, it's going to be something implanted in you, and if you take it, then you're going to hell, and if you don't take it, you know, or something like that. And
maybe they're just planning ahead. They want to keep lying. We got to keep plan. We got to plan ahead. But these chips are coming.
They were certainly lying to me, but
I think there's going to be a language, a universal language, they figure out how to teach to children.
That'd be fascinating.
Starting with children, because children learn languages very easily, and if they develop a universal language that is somehow or another either translated through computers, because you know they have a thing now, these Google earbuds that you use with a Pixel 2 phone. So if you were talking to me in Spanish, I would hear the translation of what you said in English in my ears. That's fucking amazing. Yeah. When I saw that, I was like, how is nobody noticing that this is step one? This is step one of a universal language.
Yeah.
The translation like to English is fascinating, but I think ultimately we're going to be able to figure out how to communicate with everybody with a new language. And this is not hard to I mean, it's obviously not easy, but it's not impossible to develop a new language, like a universal language that's accepted by everybody.
Yeah. I used to I have a Brazilian friend that comes up to my house sometimes, and we put the Google Translate thing just right in between us, and you can talk, and it detects which language and says it.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So it knows which language. Like, it'll know who's talking without even, you don't have earphones or nothing. It'll just say it out loud. Yeah.
That's amazing.
It's not, I mean, it's not 100% accurate. Sometimes you have to play around.
But I think this is one step. And then I think the next step is going to be some sort of a way to detect whether or not people are lying. And then another step is going to be more enhanced communication. And then another step after that is going to be some sort of telekinetic or some sort of communication without verbalizing, without words.
Oh, fuck.
I think that's coming.
I'll just be out in the woods. Yeah, y'all do your thing. Yeah. I'm going to hang out here.
It might be the best way to live. I mean,
that's how I want to live. I mean, my wife is more of a
city person.
Sort of. I mean,
got to get a weekend spot in Evergreen or something.
Dude, I want to. Yeah. I'm supposed to do a thing with what's his name? Denver Rourke.
Oh,
The Navy SEAL. He's doing like a campfire thing up there. Supposed to do that next couple
weeks.
I was just
chatting with him yesterday. We were texting each other. Yeah.
About the campfire thing?
No, he's going to come on and do the podcast whenever he's in town. We're just trying to figure out a time.
Yeah, I was texting with him on Twittering. He's doing, I guess it's called like a campfire session. So you go out there and hang out at this campfire, and he just tells stories. And,
yeah. He's a fascinating guy. He's been on my friend Steve's television show, Meat Eater.
Okay.
He's been on
I've seen that.
Yeah. He's a fascinating, intense guy.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to bring my kids, but I don't, you know.
He's a great guy. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you could bring your kids, but I think anytime you could get a place where you get away, where you can get to nature, to see the real stars at night and have a campfire. It's just reinvigorating. It's just great for you.
Man, did you see the eclipse? Did you?
No.
You didn't do
I
that
I looked
thing?
A little bit in my backyard, but I almost burned my eyes. So I don't have the right goggles. I tried to put two sunglasses on. I was like, that don't work.
That was like probably the deepest nature. Well, my wife, her family's up in Vermont, so we get some pretty deep nature up there.
Oh,
but we were up in this place in Wyoming where, I mean, there was a million people there that weekend, but I don't think, you know, there's probably not 100 people within, you know, 100 miles, right?
Right.
And, man, that was the first time I ever looked up in the sky and could see the Milky Way, though.
Oh, you know what you got to do? If you go to Hawaii, you got to plan it for when there's no moon and go to the Keck Observatory. There's the Keck Observatory on the Big Island. Fuck, man, because the Big Island is designed, they have the lighting system. Yeah, it's darker, but they have the lighting system designed in the Big Island to have diffused lighting on the street lamps. What that means is that the light doesn't disperse into the sky. Yeah. And so when you go up to the Keck Observatory, man, you see everything. It blew me away. I saw it. Yeah, that's what it looks like. Like, legitimately what it looks like.
Fuck.
Like, you go up there and you look up and you're like, holy shit. Because it's so high. I think it's 13,000 feet above sea level.
Oh, wow.
And you go up there and...
I didn't know they had mountains that big up there.
Oh, yeah, they do on the Big Island. The Big Island has...
It's like a different world.
They have a bunch of different ecosystems up there. They have a rainforest. They have a desert. They have mountain ranges. They have lava. But it changed my life, and I'm not bullshitting. It's like a psychedelic experience.
Dude.
When I went up there and saw the stars like that, I was like, oh, I don't even...
I mean, if there's something to make you feel like a tiny fucking speck.
Yeah. You feel like you're on a spaceship. You feel like you're on a spaceship flying through
the
universe.
That's how I felt when I was in Wyoming, yeah.
It's just you...
I mean, and that eclipse obviously blew me away, too.
You don't realize how many stars are up there and how much our streetlights are fucking us over.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's changing the way you view the cosmos itself. It's changing your relationship that you have with infinity, with the universe. I mean, it's changing it because it's dulling our perceptions by limiting all of this spectacular light and these stars that the Milky Way. Like, this whole thing, there's a reason why it gives you this sense of awe. Like, it's a perspective enhancer. It gives you this view of something that's impossibly beautiful and also impossibly huge. And it just puts it all in perspective. I think it's one of the reasons why people are so cocky in cities. They're missing that. They're missing this reality check.
And the weird part is, like, that's small.
Yeah. That
right?
Shit.
Like, this is actually, the Milky Way is like a small galaxy, right?
Yeah, it's nothing.
Yeah.
It's one of hundreds of billions of galaxies in the known universe.
Yeah, and there's not aliens, eh?
Well, I was talking, and I did Neil deGrasse Tyson's TV show a couple of days ago, and he was telling me that it's the most likely scenario is that we live in multiverses, and that our universe, which is impossibly large, is one of an infinite number of universes that are all in these, like, bubbles.
Can you explain that?
Like, nope. He said it to me, and I was like, wait, what? Like, is this?
I mean, you kind of got to take
images,
his word.
Is what
right?
It looks like.
Googled it, and this is images that pop up.
You kind of got to just trust him on that one, right?
Well, whenever he says something, I kind of got to just trust him.
You're the expert, bro.
Anytime I talk to astrophysicists, I just try to probe as much as possible and just trust them.
Yeah, you can't argue with him about it. Right?
But the idea is that, like, how we have a planet, and the planet's a part of a solar system, and the solar system is a part of a galaxy, and the galaxy is a part of the universe. The universe is a part of a multiverse. And then there's a fractal nature to it all, and it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And the idea that's multiverse is that there's infinite number of different universes.
Now, did he say that's theoretically the most likely, or that's there's some sort of evidence, or there's some reason to believe it outside? Because my biggest thing is we have all these theories for all this shit.
Yeah.
You know, Big Bang, God, whatever. However far the universe is. But can our minds really even wrap around what, you know, the reality probably actually is? Our minds may not even be able to conceive the reality of this. You know what I mean? It may be beyond our imagination.
Well, yeah, our imagination is kind of limited to the things that we're supposed to be experiencing, what we're here. You know, we could abstractly think about things outside of that. But even when someone says to you, like, 100 billion stars, you're like, wow, it's a lot. But that number's not even getting in my head, even after I've said it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what that means. What does that even mean? That
they say there's more stars than grains of sand on the Earth.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what blows me away. I mean, you just look at a jar of sand.
Yeah, those are giant balls of fire, maybe more than a million times bigger than Earth, just floating in the sky.
So we could see at the eclipse, they had a little observatory, like all the colleges and stuff were there where we were at, and you could see... you come back in like 10 minutes, and every 10 minutes come back and look through this one telescope, and you can see a star going around a star.
Wow.
That was fucking cool.
Yeah, I read something yesterday that Pluto is so far away that when the time they discovered it in 1930, it still hasn't made a complete orbit around the sun.
Oh, shit. How long does it take to orbit?
I don't know.
Probably a long time.
Long fucking time.
So, the funniest part is the kids are sitting there and they're like, oh, yeah, that's cool. Can we get some fucking marshmallows or what? Yeah. Some s'mores?
I need to play video games. Pluto's unusual orbit takes 248 Earth years for Pluto to complete one orbit around the sun. Its orbital path doesn't lie in the same plane as the eight planets, but is inclined at an angle of 17 degrees. And it's not even a planet anymore.
Mm.
Woo! Yeah, mind fucker. There it goes. How about Elon Musk? That crazy asshole shot a fucking Tesla up into space yesterday with a mannequin on board singing a David Bowie song.
Oh, there wasn't people on board?
No, a mannequin.
Oh, I thought there was real people.
A dude sitting in a Tesla Roadster that's like a mannequin. Like, it looks like a dude. And he's there. That's what
live.
It looks like.
It's live.
Yeah. Is this live right now? You can see it?
Yeah, that song's on a billion time loop. It's going to play for a
billion
years.
Wait a minute, what's it? They sent this into space?
How does he have the battery for the song to keep playing?
He's got some sun energy.
He's lying. He's lying. The guy's lying. These batteries run out of... They go. You go 248 miles, that car runs out of gas.
Sure, explain it.
Wait a minute. I thought... I thought he sent actual fucking rockets.
Yeah, there was an actual rocket, and a Tesla Roadster with a mannequin in it was attached to the rocket. So at the very apex of this rocket, as you know, these multi-stage rockets, they pop this bitch out, and it goes flying through space. He shot a fucking car into space. Like, imagine aliens coming to Earth, and this is like the first thing they found. They go, what the fuck is this? Is that a person? No.
Circuit board.
There's the richest, craziest guy. One of the richest, craziest guys on Earth, one of the smartest guys, he just launches cars into space for a goof. They're like, these people are assholes.
You see a lot of rich people that maybe they just want to get richer.
Picture.
They just want to get richer or something, right? Like, this dude's, how much money is he blowing on this shit?
It says made on Earth by humans.
Yeah,
I think he blew $100 million to do this. Click on that link of the image of the Tesla with the Earth behind it.
There.
Yeah.
It's CGI, bro. The Earth is flat, man.
I mean, that is just what a crazy image.
Dude, I want to hear. I never talked to Eddie about that. I want to hear his real theory on that.
Eddie Bravo?
Yeah.
Don't talk to him about it.
Gotta change.
Dude, I want to hear it.
It'll change the way you think.
It's got to change now. There's a whole video of this going from the bottom to the top.
No, it doesn't. It's not based in reality, man. It's not based in logic or reason. It's based
He has no logic behind it?
He wants to think the Earth's flat. He's like, you don't know. He doesn't trust science. Doesn't trust scientists, doesn't trust anybody.
I mean, I get that, but you got to have some logic still to back it up, right?
You know what? One of the things that makes Eddie so good at jiu-jitsu is he has an idea to get a move on you, and he's fucking completely locked on that idea, and everything that's trying to shut that down is just like he needs to come up with a defense for that.
He's going to find a way.
That's how he looks at ideas as well.
Okay.
So if he has an idea that the Earth is flat or that there's lizard people that live under the ground, like it's like you got to prove,
too?
I don't know. You got to prove that that's not real to him.
Okay.
And if you can't prove that that's not real, and you say, well, look at these pictures. Oh, that's bullshit. They fake it. They faked the moon landing six times.
Yeah, you got to give me more than that. I wanted to hear his actual argument, but
sit
I didn't know it was
him. Sit down with him. I'll film it.
I wanted to.
I'll turn the camera on and I'll leave the room.
I went to his gym a couple weeks ago, and I'd always heard that he talks a lot at his gym or kind of goes on about different
conspiracies,
things like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was totally prepared. I was like, fuck yeah, let's go hear it. Like, he didn't do anything. He didn't barely even talk. We just rolled the whole time.
He's probably happy you were there. He wanted to show you some jiu-jitsu. Like, he's a jiu-jitsu wizard.
He did. He showed me some good jiu-jitsu.
He just...
I like his system.
It's an intense system.
The moves I only know so much, but the concept of what do we do at 99% of jiu-jitsu classes, you go practice some new technique you probably never did before.
And then you start rolling.
And then you roll.
Yeah.
And his, when we went there, we drilled. And this reminded me much more of like a wrestling style practice. And I liked it a lot in that terms.
Well, that's why he designed it that way. He's a real jiu-jitsu genius. He really is.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the conspiracy thing, I think he just enjoys it. He loves them. He loves it. He's always sending me crazy shit.
I'm afraid I'll love it too much, like, once I actually have the time. Mm.
It's a giant distraction. If you think Instagram is a distraction, go try to...
Well, that's the problem. I mean, you can't... Like, there's no website, maybe there should be, where you can just go on and say, okay, this is what this side believes about it, this is what this side believes about it, and you make up your own mind. You got to dig through... fucking InfoWars every time. And of course, like, if you try to tell someone, like, dude, it's true, I said it on InfoWars, they're like, okay,
right,
you're full of shit.
There's a few websites like that, right? Like the Daily Mail. You read it on the Daily Mail and you're like, get the fuck,
like the Radar or something like that.
There's a bunch of them. Yeah. There's a bunch of weird ones. Matt Brown, I gotta wrap this up. I gotta get the fuck out of here. But listen, man, I appreciate your time. Yeah, I appreciate you being here. It's a pleasure. It's an honor. When are you fighting Carlos Condit?
April 14th.
Ooh, April 14th, motherfuckers. Tune in. And it's I Am the Immortal on Instagram, right?
Yeah.
And what's your Twitter?
Same.
All right.
Same, I Am the Immortal, and then immortalcombatequipment.co.
Thanks, brother. It's a pleasure. All right. Thank you.